Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Star Wars Jedi Search by Kevin J. Anderson. The black hole cluster reached out for the Millennium Falcon with jaws of gravity drawing it close. Even in the mottled blur of hyperspace, Han Solo could see the huge distortion as a bruised whirlpool trying to suck them down to infinity.
Hey, Chewie, that's too close.
He stared at the Falcon's navicomputer, wishing they had chosen a course that would take them a safer distance from the Maw.
What do you think this is, an old smuggling mission? We've got nothing to hide this time.
Beside him, Chewbacca looked disappointed and waved his hairy hands in the stifling air of the cockpit.
Yeah, well, we're on an official mission this time. No more skulking about. Try to act dignified, okay?
Han felt a pang at returning to his old haunts, reminded of when he had been just on the other side of the law, running spice, chased by Imperial scout ships, when his life had been free and easy. On one of those frantic missions, he and Chewbacca had shaved the bottom plating off the Falcon, taking a shortcut and skimming closer to the Maw cluster of black holes than had ever before been recorded. Sensible pilots avoided the area, using longer paths that kept them clear of the black holes. But the Falcon's speed had carried them to safety on the other side, making the Kessel run in under 12 parsecs. That mission had ended in disaster, anyway. Han had dumped his load of spice just before being boarded by Imperials. This time, though, Han was returning to Kessel under different circumstances. His wife, Leia, had appointed him an official representative of the New Republic, an ambassador of sorts. Han Solo found himself in the unlikely and uncomfortable position of being respectable. There was no other word for it. But Han's new responsibilities weren't just quaint annoyances. He was married to Leia. Who could have imagined that? And he had three children. Han leaned back in his flight chair and locked his fingers behind his head. He allowed a wistful smile to cross his face. He had visited the kids as often as he could in their protective isolation on the secret planet, and the twins were due to come home to Coruscant in a week. Anakin, his third child, still a baby, filled him with wonder. But he would have to remain on the secret planet with Leia's old friend Winter as his nanny. Han caught Chewbacca looking at him out of the corner of his eye. Embarrassed, he sat up straight and frowned down at the controls.
Now, where are we? Shouldn't it be about time to end this jump?
Chewbacca growled in affirmative, then grasped the hyperspace controls. The mottled coloring of hyperspace fanned into star lines and resolved into stars. Kessel looked like a wraith coasting along its orbit, too small to hold on to its own atmosphere. Huge generating factories constantly processed raw rocks to release oxygen and carbon dioxide, making it possible for people to survive outside with simple breath masks instead of total environment suits. A good portion of the newly manufactured atmosphere escaped into space, wisping behind the small planet like the tail of a giant comet. Kessel was a major planet for spice production, and seat of heavy smuggling activities, as well as the site for one of the toughest prisons in the galaxy. The Empire had controlled spice production, except for what smugglers managed to steal from under Imperial noses. But with the fall of the Emperor, the smugglers and the prisoners in the Imperial Correction Facility took over the planet. Kessel had laid low during the depredations of Grand Admiral Thrawn and the recent resurrection of the Emperor, trying hard not to be noticed, answering no one's request for help. With the Civil War ended and the New Republic once again firmly seated on Coruscant, leaving scattered groups of Imperial warships to fight each other, it was time to reopen negotiations.
Better get them on our side, Han thought.
As representative of the new unified smugglers, Luke's old nemesis Mara Jade had tried to contact Kessel and been flatly rebuffed. The Millennium Falcon approached Kessel, firing aft thrusters to help them catch up with the planet's motion, preparing for insertion into orbit. On the helm scanner screens, Han checked their approach.
Vectoring in.
Han looked down to see blips already in orbit around the planet, emerging from the blanketing clouds of the atmosphere.
Yeah, I see them. Looks like about a half dozen ships. Too far away to determine the types.
Han brushed aside Chewie's uneasiness.
Well, then, we'll just tell them who we are.
Why do you think Leia made such a fuss about getting us proper diplomatic ID signals and everything? Han toggled the audio pickup switch on.
This is Han Solo of the New Republic ship Millennium Falcon. We're on a diplomatic mission.
But the two closest ships roared toward him at unbelievable speed, spreading out on either side. The sight of their squared-off solar panels and central pilot compartments turned Han's blood to ice water.
TIE fighters. Chewie, get over here. I'm taking the laser cannon.
Han hauled himself up the access tube into the gunwale. One of the attacking ships swooped overhead, and the Falcon's sensor panels howled with the sound of twin ion engines, from which the TIE fighter took its name. The enemy vessel fired, but the beams streaked harmlessly through space. Other ships were approaching, and somehow Han didn't think they were coming to help the Falcon. Up ahead, the two TIE fighters swooped up in a tight arc and roared back for a second attack. But by this time, Han had managed to strap himself into the gunner's chair and to power up the laser batteries. The instant he pressed the firing button, Chewbacca threw the Falcon into an evasive roll. Han's laser blasts went wide, spraying toward the distant stars. The TIE fighter shot also missed, streaking in the opposite direction and coming perilously close to striking the second TIE fighter. The second fighter managed to readjust his aim quickly enough that his two shots scored the Falcon's shields. According to Chewie's preliminary damage report, the aft shields were gone. Forward shields were still holding well. That meant they had to take the TIE fighters head-on. As the first fighter swung around for a third pass, Han swiveled his gun turret as far as it would go. As soon as the targeting cross touched the image of the fighter, Han squeezed his firing buttons at full power, strafing his deadly laser across the path of the incoming ship. The ship erupted into a flame flower of exploding fuel tanks and expanding atmosphere. Han and Chewbacca shouted their triumph in unison.
Let's go get the other one, Chewie.
Chewbacca increased speed, closing the gap between the Falcon and the remaining TIE fighter, which was heading back toward Kessel.
Just get me one good shot, Chewie, one good shot.
Another ship roared up from behind as they chased the TIE fighter. Han fired off a few bursts from his laser, but they all missed. Then he turned his attention to the ship tailing them. It was an X-Wing fighter, and it was slowly gaining on the Falcon. The X-Wing fired. The laser scored a direct hit, incinerating the protruding sensor dish mounted on the top of the ship.
Turn us around! Turn us around!
Han shouted. They had to get their unprotected aft section out of the X-Wing's line of fire. The X-Wing shot again. All the lights went out inside the ship. With the Falcon sensor dish slagged, Han couldn't send out a distress call. He couldn't even surrender. Han's mind raced. They could skim around Kessel in a tight orbit, then slingshot back out of the system. With the black hole cluster so close at hand, no one would risk jumping into hyperspace without intensive prior calculations, and neither he nor Chewie could spare time to do them. Suddenly, Han's mouth dropped open. As they swept around Kessel, Han detected wave after wave of fighter ships launching from the garrison moon. Seeing it would serve no purpose to keep firing against overwhelming odds, Han dropped back down the access shaft of the gun turret to the cockpit. He settled himself into the other pilot's chair, just in time to see the indicator lights for the forward shields wink out. They were now totally unprotected, as another hit rocked them.
There goes the main drive unit, Chewie. We're space meat in the next barrage. Take us down. Get us into the atmosphere. It's the only thing we can do.
As Chewbacca expressed his disbelief, Han grabbed the controls and sent them lurching down toward Kessel.
It's gonna be a bumpy ride. Hold on to your fur.
Amidst a hail of hostile fire, they plunged through the atmosphere. The surface of Kessel rushed up at them like a gigantic hammer. Han fought with the controls.
Now, at least we'll have a soft landing with the new repulsorless we installed.
He started priming the controls. Nothing.
What?
Han slammed his fingers on the switch again and again, but the repulsor lifts refused to operate.
I just had those fixed.
Chewbacca had no time to answer before the ship crashed into the rugged surface of Kessel. The towers of Imperial City rose to the sky high above the shadowed surface of the planet Coruscant. The cornerstones of the towers had been in place for more than 1,000 generations, dating back to the formative days of the Old Republic. Over the millennia, higher and higher structures had been built on top of the old ruined foundations. Luke Skywalker stepped onto a shuttle landing platform that jutted out from the monolithic face of the former Imperial Palace. Gusts of wind whipped around him, and he pulled back the hood of his Jedi robe. He looked into the sky, pondering the thin layer of atmosphere that protected Coruscant from space beyond. Wrecked ships still rode in haphazard orbits, debris from the recent vicious war to recapture the planet from Imperial control. Luke was biding his time. The New Republic Senate had been in session for only an hour, and they would still be working on mundane issues. Luke wanted to startle them after they had been talking for a while. The immense metropolis of Imperial City bustled around him, little changed now that it was the seat of the New Republic instead of the Empire. Prior to that, it had been capital of the Old Republic. The capital building, formerly Emperor Palpatine's palace, was made of polished gray-green rock and mirrored crystals which sparkled in the hazy sunlight of Coruscant. Much of Imperial City had been laid waste during the months of civil war following the downfall of Grand Admiral Thrawn. The various factions of the old empire had fought over the Emperor's home world, turning vast districts into graveyards of crashed ships and exploded buildings. But the tide of battle had turned, and the New Republic had driven back the vestiges of the Empire. Many Alliance soldiers now turned their efforts to repairing the damage, Luke's friend Wedge Antilles among them. The Emperor's own construction droids ranged through the battle-scarred wastelands, automatically scraping up raw materials from the wreckage for conversion into new buildings. In the distance, Luke could see one of the enormous droids, 40 stories tall, wrecking a half-collapsed building shell and plowing a path where its programming had deemed a new road should be routed. Its girder arms toppled the stone face of the building and fed the debris into the processing mouth, where the materials would be separated and new components extruded. During the previous year of violent strife, Luke had been whisked away to the resurrected Emperor's stronghold in the galactic core. And there, he had allowed himself to learn the dark side. He had become the Emperor's chief lieutenant, just like his father, Darth Vader. The struggle had been great within him, and only with the help and the friendship and the love of Leia and Han had he been able to break free. He had survived tests and rigors more potent than routine Jedi training prepared him for. Luke understood more about the Force now than he had ever dreamed possible. Sometimes it terrified him. He turned and walked back inside the palace, pulling his robe tightly around himself. Luke stood at the entrance to the Senate Assembly Chamber. The room swept down to a giant amphitheater in which sat the inner circle of appointed senators and outer rows of representatives from different planets, different alien races. Mon Mothma, the New Republic's chief of state, spoke now on the central dais. With her short reddish hair and gentle voice, Mon Mothma did not look like a tough-as-nails military commander. As a former member of the Imperial Senate, she seemed to be more in her element now, trying to forge the pieces of the New Republic into a strong, unified government. Beside Mon Mothma sat Luke's sister, Leia Organa Solo. Leia had been performing more and more important diplomatic activities with each passing month. Finishing her speech, Mon Mothma raised her hands. "I call for any new business. Does anyone wish to speak?" Luke's timing had been perfect. He stepped into the light at the entrance archway and drew back his hood. "I would like to address the assembly, Mon Mothma, if I may." As he descended the long ramp, Luke felt all eyes turned toward him. A hush fell over the assembly. Luke Skywalker, the lone remaining Jedi Master, almost never took part in governmental proceedings. Mon Mothma gave him a soft, mysterious smile and gestured for him to take a central position. "The words of a Jedi Knight are always welcome to the New Republic." Luke tried not to look pleased. She had provided the perfect opening for him. "In the Old Republic, Jedi Knights were the protectors and guardians of all. For 1,000 generations, the Jedi used the powers of the Force to guide, defend, and provide support for the rightful government of worlds, before the dark days of the Empire came and the Jedi Knights were killed. Now I am the only Jedi Master who remains. Without that order of protectors to provide a backbone of strength for the New Republic, can we survive? What will happen when we begin squabbling among ourselves over petty matters? The old Jedi helped to mediate many types of disputes. What if there are no Jedi Knights to protect us in the difficult times ahead? Luke fixed his gaze on all the senators present. He turned his attention to Leia last. Her eyes were wide, but supportive. He had not discussed his idea with her beforehand.
My sister is undergoing Jedi training. She has a great deal of skill in the Force. Her three children are also likely candidates to be trained as young Jedi. In recent years, I have come to know a woman named Mara Jade, who is now unifying the smugglers, the former smugglers, into an organization that can support the needs of the New Republic. She also has a talent for the Force. I have encountered others in my travels. But are these the only ones? I have come here to ask... He gestured toward Mon Mothma and swept his hand across the people gathered there in the chamber. For two things. First, that the New Republic officially sanction my search for those with a hidden talent for the Force to try to bring them to our service. Mon Mothma sat up straighter in her central seat. I think we can agree to that without further discussion. She looked around to the other senators, seeing them nod agreement. Tell us your second request. Luke stood taller. If sufficient candidates are found who have potential for using the Force, I wish to be allowed, with the New Republic's blessing, to establish in some appropriate place an intensive training center. A Jedi Academy, if you will. Senator Garm Bel-Iblis, who had brought his dreadnought ships against the Imperial Admiral Thrawn, rose slowly to his feet.
A comment, if I may. I'm sorry, Luke, but I have to raise the question. We just recently fought against Jorah Sabaoth, and, of course, Darth Vader nearly caused the death of us all. If a teacher as great as Obi-Wan Kenobi could fail and let his student fall to evil, how can we take the risk of training an entire new order of Jedi Knights? How many will turn to the dark side?
Luke nodded somberly. The question had been working at the back of his own mind, and he had pondered it deeply.
I can only say that we have seen these terrible examples, and we must learn from them. I myself have touched the dark side, and come through stronger and more wary of its powers than ever before.
Admiral Akbar got to his feet and applauded with his flipper-like hands.
I agree that the Jedi's request is in the best interests of the New Republic.
Soon all the senators were standing. Luke saw a broad grin on Leia's face as she too stood. Mon Mothma nodded gravely. She was the last to stand up, and she raised her hand for silence. I give you my hopes for the rebirth of the Jedi Knights. We will offer whatever help we can. May the Force be with you. The sculpture on Leia's crystal table jittered forward, stopped, then rose into the air. The figure was a fat man with spread palms and a grin wide enough to swallow an X-Wing fighter. The dealer had assured Leia that it was a genuine Corellian sculpture, that it would make Han recall fond memories of his own world. Upon receiving the anniversary gift, Han thanked her profusely, but could barely control his laughter. He finally explained that the statue was a trademarked figurine stolen from a chain of cheap Corellian eating establishments.
Keep concentrating, Leia,
Luke whispered, leaning closer. He watched her intently. Her eyes were focused on the far distance, not seeing the sculpture at all. The statue continued to levitate, rising higher off the table. Suddenly it bumped forward to topple onto the floor. Leia heaved a sigh and slumped back in the self-conforming chair. Luke tried to cover his disappointment. His sister's training had been much less rigorous than his own with Yoda, and more haphazard as she continually rescheduled lessons to accommodate her increasing diplomatic duties. But Leia concerned him. He had been working with her for more than 7 years now, and she seemed to be blocked, having reached the limit of the powers she could master. He reached out with his fingers to touch her dark hair. I'm going to try to probe your mind. Try to resist me, or at least pinpoint where I am. Luke half closed his eyes, then sent faint tendrils of thoughts into her mind, deftly touching the topography of her memory. At first she didn't react, but then he could feel her concentrating, building an invisible wall around his probe. Luke reached to the back of her mind, an area of deep primal memories but little conscious thought. He touched inward to an isolated nub in her mind. He pushed, and suddenly felt as if a giant invisible palm had planted itself on his chest and shoved backward. He stumbled to keep his balance, taking two steps away from her. Leia's mouth dropped open in surprise.
"What did you do?"
Luke asked. "I didn't do anything," she replied. Luke allowed himself to smile. "Your reflexes did, Leia. When a medical droid taps your knees, your leg jerks whether you want it to or not. We may have just stumbled onto something a potential Jedi has that others don't."
At least the ship didn't explode on impact.
That was the first thing Han Solo thought as painful consciousness returned. Somehow they had survived a crash landing. His eyes widened as he saw red splashes across the control panels. His own blood. His leg felt as if it were on fire, and he tasted liquid tin in his mouth. Turning his head, he saw the Wookiee in the co-pilot's chair, his pelt matted with blood. Someone from outside managed to hotwire the ramp, and he heard heavy footsteps marching across it. Han wanted to pull out his blaster, but he could barely raise his eyes. The intruders wore a hodgepodge of armor, some parts modified from prison guard uniforms, other plates adapted from stormtrooper equipment. None of it made any sense to Han, but his mind had already maxed out with things that should never have happened. A TIE fighter and an X-Wing fighting side by side? Against him? A man who looked like a scarecrow with impossibly long arms and neck strode into the Falcon's cockpit. Han felt recognition stir inside him, but he couldn't pinpoint a name. The scarecrow turned wide-set, flinty eyes on him.
"Han Solo."
Though the breath mask covered his lower face, Han could tell the man was grinning widely.
"You're going to wish you never survived landing on Kessel."
With a flash of memory, the scarecrow's name came to Han. Skinksnacks. That was it. But Skinksnacks had been locked up in the Imperial Correction Facility. Questions had just begun forming in Han's mouth when Skinksnacks brought an armored fist down on his head, sending him back into unconsciousness.
Kessel. Spice. Han's thoughts mixed into nightmares as he fought to come back to himself. He'd always been proud to boast that the Falcon had made the Kessel run in record time, but he rarely recounted the whole tale. He got the shipment, as always, from Morath Duel, the frog-like man who had been in charge of skimming black market spice from Imperial production quotas. Duel was some sort of official in the gigantic Imperial prison complex from which came most of the spice mine laborers. The Empire maintained strict control over the spice output, but Duel managed to keep quite a little side market of his own. Han Solo and Chewbacca had run spice for him, whisking it past Imperial patrols and putting it into distribution channels run by gangsters such as Jabba the Hutt. But Duel had a habit of stringing along his helpers until he decided he could gain bigger favor by turning them over to the authorities. Han had never been able to prove it, but he suspected that Duel himself had tipped off the tariff ships about the Falcon's flight away from Kessel. Han had been forced to jettison his entire cargo of Glitterstim spice worth a fortune just before being boarded. The lost cargo of spice alone had been worth 12,400 credits. And Jabba the Hutt had already paid for it in full. Jabba had not been pleased. Opening his eyes, Han stared up into the bullet-like face of a medical droid. Around him, the prison medical center was white and cold. When he tried to turn his head, the medical droid clamped its cold metal hands against his temples. "You must remain motionless. This will hurt a great deal. Now relax. Immediately." Chewie shook him awake with a hairy, enthusiastic, and grateful hug. Han groaned and blinked his eyes. His entire body felt as if it had been beaten instead of healed. Chewbacca looked scruffy and haggard. After treatment, the two of them had been tossed into this dank place. The gigantic cell had green and blue smears of slime oozing down its walls. The only noise was the sound of dripping. "How long have we been here, Chewie? Do you know?"
Chewbacca didn't. The door clicked and rose, flooding the room with garish white light.
"Get ready, Chewie."
The skeletal figure silhouetted in the door was obviously Skinksnacks.
"We want to learn exactly why you came to spy on Kessel," he said.
A lift took them past the main cell block areas and then along a tube to the outer corners of the correctional facility. Looking through the scratched, transparent walls of the elevator, Han could see that the prison itself was a massive tan and gray edifice made of plasteel and synthetic rock. A glassed and mirrored substructure protruded from the face, housing the administrative offices and prison personnel. In the racing elevator, Skinksnecks kept his modified double blaster trained on them. Both Han and Chewbacca had been strapped into stun cuffs, a restraining fixture across the wrists that sent paralyzing jolts of electricity directly into the nervous system, proportional in strength to the amount of struggle a prisoner exerted. Skinksnecks escorted them through administrative offices, many of which had been ransacked or burned. Han complied and walked easily ahead. He'd had his troubles with Morath Duel, and he did not trust the man a bit. But as far as he knew, there was no powerful grudge between them. They went past a broad anteroom to a huge office faced by giant windows that looked out upon the barrens of Kessel. Powerful radiation shields in orbit filtered out a large percentage of the deadly X-rays and gamma rays pouring from the nearby maw. If not for the precious spice, no one would bother trying to live on Kessel. The original sign on the desk unit announced this to be the Warden's headquarters, but someone had crossed out the previous ID tag and mounted a hand-lettered sign in Basic, Duel's Place. On the wall to the right of the desk unit hung a man captured in final throes of agony, frozen in carbonite. Duel had taken a lesson from Jabba, displaying some old nemesis for all to see, and shivered just looking at the trophy. Next to the window, a barrel-shaped form stood silhouetted by the garish light. Morath Duel. Duel was a Rybet, squat and soft-skinned. His bright green coloring and tan highlights looked like worm stripes up and down his cheeks, arms, and shoulders. His skin was dry, but so smooth it looked shiny. Duel sported a bright yellow cravat, which meant he was in mating readiness, though Han couldn't imagine where on the planet Duel would ever find a willing female of his own species. Duel turned around, displaying a much-changed face. His Rybet eyes were overlarge, lantern-like, with vertical slits, but one of his eyes was now milky white, like a half-cooked egg. He wore a mechanical focusing device over his other eye, strapped onto his smooth head with brown leather straps. Duel fiddled with his mechanical eye, and the lenses clicked and whirred into place like a camera unit. After a long inspection, he finally hissed in recognition.
"It is you, Han Solo."
Han frowned. "I've been hitting the spice too heavily, I see, Morath. Always gets the eyesight first." Duel tapped the contraption in his eye.
"It wasn't spice that did this. When you dumped your load of glitter stem, Jabba blamed it on me. He tried to have me killed. I had to beg them to take only my eye. I had to beg them to take my eye. All because of your cowardice."
Chewbacca expressed his outrage, and Han barely kept his own anger in check. "Jabba put out a contract on me too, Duel. Boba Fett captured me on Bespin, and I was trapped in carbonite just like your friend there." He gestured to the gruesome trophy on the wall. "And I got set to Jabba anyway." Duel waved a hand in dismissal.
"Jabba's men had already infiltrated the spice mining operations, and he wanted to expose me so his own people could procure the glitter stim directly. His hitman would have done more than nearly blind me, but Skinksnecks killed him."
At the doorway, the Scarecrow smiled with pride.
"Jabba forced my hand, and I had to act. We staged the prison revolt. The Warden himself was Jabba's man. That's him up on the wall there. But half the guards were on my side. I paid them well, you see. Luckily, the Empire was thrown into chaos right about the same time. We took Kessel for ourselves. I've been stockpiling spice supplies and building up a massive defense fleet with everything I can scrape together. Nobody, and I mean nobody, is going to come here and take things away from me. Everything was going just fine before you had to get Jabba angry at me. Everything was safe. I knew just how to play the game. Now I'm jumping at shadows, afraid every moment."
Duel stared at Han.
"Did you think you could just fly into our space, look around, and go back to your republic with all the information they need to come take us over?"
He slapped his palm on the desktop with a damp splat.
We'll strike the first blow by killing you, their spy. And we will be ready to blast them out of the sky the moment their attack ships come out of hyperspace.
Pondering how Leia might have handled a situation like this, Han tried as tactfully as possible to convince Duel that he and Chewie had come to Kessel on a mission of peace. Duel did not believe a word of it.
I'll get the information out of you quickly now, but I may have time to enjoy interrogating you later, just on general principle.
Duel placed his webbed palm on top of a sealed container. The box was filled with slender, black-wrapped cylinders about half as long as a finger. Glitterstim, Han said.
Duel looked at him.
The most potent form of spice. With it, I'll be able to read the truth of what you say.
Duel selected one of the slim black cylinders. With a deft motion, he peeled off the opaque outer wrapper and withdrew a thin bundle of transparent glossy fibers. As he held the inert glitter stem up to the light, pouring through the broad viewing window, the light-sensitive spice began to scintillate and glow from within, ripening. Duel opened his mouth when the segment of glitter stem glowed a pearlescent blue. He extended his sharp, purplish tongue to wrap around the crystalline fibers, which he drew back into his mouth. The spice would work on Duel's mind, pump up his latent powers. Han winced as he felt tiny fingers clawing around in his brain, picking through the lobes of memory, images he had stored in his thoughts, searching, searching. Han felt anger growing, outraged that Morath Duel could dissect the private moments he had with Leia. But the spice effects lasted only a few moments, and Duel would be concerned mainly with learning why Han and Chewbacca had come to Kessel.
I really was telling you the truth, Duel. We came in peace, but you just declared war on yourself by shooting down the New Republic's first ambassadors.
The Rybet's mouth hung slack, glitter-stim sparks sputtering around his cheeks.
No!
Duel whirled to glare at Skinksnecks.
What are we going to do? He's telling the truth.
He can't be. He's...
Their spice doesn't lie. He's here for exactly the reasons he said. The New Republic is going to come after us, and they'll wipe us out.
Kill the two of them now. If we work fast, we can cover everything up.
Han felt fear return.
Now, wait a minute. I'm sure we can fix this up with a few careful messages. I am the ambassador, after all. Diplomatic credentials and everything. I wouldn't want a simple misunderstanding.
No, we can't risk that. Duel, you know what Solo has done before. He knows you tipped off the Imperial tariff ships to go after him.
Actually, Han hadn't been certain until that very moment.
Now, there's no need to panic. I can talk to the New Republic Senate.
Duel tapped a finger against his swollen lips.
I agree with Skinksnacks. I'll review the battle tapes, but I don't believe you transmitted any messages after coming out of hyperspace. One of our fighters shot off your communications dish. The New Republic has no way of knowing you arrived safely. With no evidence, they will conclude you got swallowed up by the Maw.
Duel began to pace in front of the large viewing window.
We'll delete any mention of you from our records. Instruct all my mercenaries to forget about the attack. Yes, that'll be the safest alternative.
You're making a big mistake. Han could barely restrain his urge to yank at the stun cuffs.
No.
Duel tapped his squishy-tipped fingers together.
I don't think so. My best bet would be to kill you right away.
Duel answered Chewbacca. Then he rubbed his fingers against his blind eye. He turned to Han.
But you still owe me for this, Solo. Even if you worked every day for 100 years, it would never repay me for the loss of my eye. You both are going down into the spice mines, the deepest and most distant tunnels.
Duel grinned with his wide frog-like mouth. A final flicker of blue sparks rippled at the corner of his lips.
No one will ever find you down there.
Luke Skywalker emerged from hyperspace into a magenta, orange, and icicle-blue galactic ocean of ionized gas known as the Cauldron Nebula. He looked at the spectacle and smiled. He punched in the coordinates for Eol Shah. His modified passenger shuttle arced through the wispy gas, leaving the nebula above him as the engines kicked in. He'd wanted to take his trusty old X-Wing, but that ship was a single-person craft with room for only an astromech droid in the back. If Luke's hunches about Jedi descendants proved correct, he would be bringing two candidates back to Coruscant with him. According to outdated records in the memory banks back on Coruscant, the settlement on Eol Shah was established a century before by entrepreneurs who intended to use ramjet mining ships to plow through the Cauldron Nebula and scoop up valuable gases. The mineship pilots would distill the gaseous harvest into pure rare elements for sale to other outposts. The nebula mining scheme had never paid off. The entrepreneurs had not counted on the true costs of ramjet ships and the unremarkable composition of the cauldron's gases. The outpost on Eol Shah had been left to fend for itself. The outpost had been rediscovered 2 years ago by a New Republic sociologist who had visited them briefly, recorded his insights, and filed a report recommending immediate evacuation of the doomed colony, all of which was promptly forgotten in the already blossoming bureaucracy of the New Republic and the fight against Grand Admiral Thrawn. The item that had attracted Luke's attention, though, was that a woman named Ta'anya, an illegitimate descendant of a Jedi, had been one of the original colonists on Eol Shah. Luke would have suspected the Jedi's bloodline had ended there, except for one small detail. According to the sociologist's report, the leader of the ragtag colonists, a man named Gantoris, was said to be able to sense impending earthquakes, and he had miraculously survived as a child when his playmates were killed in an avalanche. Luke felt these stories were exaggerated, but still, the clues and the circumstantial evidence led him to Eol Shah. He had to follow every lead if he was to find enough candidates for his Jedi training center. The shuttle settled onto the planet's rocky terrain, and Luke exited through flip-up doors behind the passenger seats. The air of Eol Shah smoldered in his nostrils, filled with acrid sulfurous smoke and chemical vapors. The gigantic moon loomed on the horizon like a platter of beaten brass, casting its own shadows even in daylight. Murky clouds and volcanic ash hovered in the air like a hazy blanket. In the near distance, hardened mounds of lava sprawled around a volcanic cone. Halfway to the decrepit habitation module that was all that was left of the human outpost, Luke fell to his knees when a jolt went through the ground. The rocks bounced and the earth rumbled. Suddenly, the random craters around him cracked, then belched towers of steam and scalding droplets of water. Geysers, all of them. He had walked into a field of geysers, triggered by the earthquake to erupt simultaneously. Steam rolled over the ground like a dense fog. When Luke finally emerged from the steam, he saw two men staring at him from the doorway of a rusted and ancient prefab shelter. "I have come to speak with Gantoris." One of the men, who identified himself as Wharton, fumbled for words, then they came out in a rush.
"Everyone is gone. There's been a rock slide in one of the crevasses. It's buried two of our youngest who went out to spear Bogdillos. Gantoris and the others are there, trying to dig them out."
Luke felt a stab of urgency and grasped Wharton's arm. "Take me there. Maybe I can help." Wharton knew exactly where to find the other survivors, in the maze of channels and partial landslides. Luke saw them, shoulder to shoulder, in an elbow of the crevasse, scrambling over newly fallen rock, working to haul boulders aside. One man worked with twice the effort of the others. His long black hair hung in a braid on the left side of his face. His eyebrows and eyelashes had been plucked away, leaving his broad face smooth and angular and flushed with his exertion. He shoved rocks aside, which the other people hauled away. By the way Wharton and the others looked to him, Luke guessed the man must be Gantoris. With a quick glance, Luke took in the positioning of the boulders. He rolled his eyes back in concentration and reached out through the force, using the strength he found there to feel the boulders, to move them, and to keep other rocks from doing further damage. When Yoda had trained him to lift large stones, it had been merely a game, a training exercise. Now two lives depended on it. He paid no attention to the astonished sounds as the colonists stepped back, ducking out of the way as Luke mentally hurled boulder after boulder from the top of the rock pile, tossing them into other parts of the crevasse. He could feel life down in the shadowy depths somewhere. "She's alive!" someone shouted, and several helpers rushed into the debris, hauling free a young girl. The young boy had not been so lucky. The avalanche had crushed him instantly. The boy had been dead long before Luke arrived. Luke kept the unstable pile of rocks steady until they had excavated the body. Amid sobs of grief, he released himself from his semi-trance and opened his eyes. Gantoris stood directly in front of him.
"Why are you here? Who are you?"
he asked. Wharton blinked in awe as he looked at Luke.
"He says he's come for you, Gantoris."
"Yes, I know."
The look on Gantoris's face seemed a frightening mixture of horror and eagerness.
"I have dreamt of you, a dark man who offers me incredible secrets, then destroys me. I am lost if I go with you."
Luke glanced at the people around him and decided to gamble. He stared directly into Gantoris's eyes. "What can I do to prove my intentions to you?" Instead of replying, Gantoris said,
"Take the dark man."
Several people reached forward to grasp Luke's arms. He did not struggle. Gantoris glared at Luke.
"We will learn why you are here."
Leia was eating breakfast on the park balcony high in Imperial Towers, thinking about the soon-to-be-returning twins and her still-missing husband. Why hadn't Han gotten in touch? She wasn't quite ready yet to admit she was worried about him. An older model protocol droid stood in the balcony's archway.
"Excuse me, Minister Organa Solo. Someone wishes to see you. Are you accepting visitors?"
Leia set down her breakfast pastry.
"Why not?"
"Probably some lobbyist wanting to complain to her in private, or a panicked minor functionary, or one of the other senators trying to hand off some of his own duties."
Instead, with a flourish of his vermilion cape, Lando Calrissian walked through the arch. Seeing him, Leia felt her mood immediately lighten. He gallantly kissed her hand, but she was not satisfied until she had given him a friendly hug.
"So what brings you to Coruscant?" Leia realized how eager she was just to have a normal conversation without diplomatic entanglements and hidden agendas.
"I just came to see how you all are doing in the big city. Where's Han?"
"He and Chewie went off to Kessel."
Kessel can be a pretty rough place."
Leia avoided his eyes.
"Han hasn't bothered to call in 6 days."
"That's not like him," Lando said.
"Oh, yes it is, and you know it.
I suppose we'll have words when he comes back day after tomorrow."
Then she forced an artificial air of brightness.
"But let's not talk about that right now. How can you find time to trot around visiting people?" "To tell you the truth, I'm between engagements right now."
Lando gave her a lopsided grin, but she frowned back at him.
"What happened to your big mining operation on Naklon? Didn't the New Republic replace most of your destroyed machinery?" "Well, it was still a lot of work and not paying off."
Leia crossed her arms and looked at him skeptically. He squirmed.
"Well, I lost it in a sobic game."
She couldn't keep herself from laughing. "So you're out of work?"
Just then, the old protocol droid shuffled to the arch again, but before he could announce his business, C-3PO and R2-D2 bustled around him, making a direct path to Leia.
"Princess Leia! Oh, General Calrissian, what are you doing here?"
3PO could not contain his excitement.
"We've found one!"
3PO dutifully translated.
"We've been looking for possible Jedi candidates for Master Luke. R2 was checking the records of various winners in different gambling establishments throughout the galaxy. We seem to have encountered a man who has extraordinary luck at the Umgulian blob races."
3PO handed a hard copy printout of the winning statistics to Leia, but she passed it on to Lando.
"You're better trained to understand this than I am."
"You will note that while Mr. Timo loses quite often in the minor races, in every instance where he has bet more than 100 credits on a particular blob, that blob won the race."
Leia's eyes sparkled.
"Someone needs to check this out. If it's just a scam, we need a person who knows his way around gambling establishments."
"Lando?
Isn't that a job you could do?"
She knew his answer before she even asked the question.
Looking at the cracked and gasping wastelands of Kessel always made Morath Duel hungry.
Duel turned from the window and went to an alcove in the office. Time for a snack. He withdrew a cage of fat and juicy flying insects. Opening the mesh door, Duel thrust his entire head into the cage. The insects fluttered around his eyes, his ears, his cheeks. Duel's sharp tongue shot out again and again, spearing the insects and slurping them into his mouth. Someone knocked on his door. Wearing the insect cage over his head, Duel turned around to see Skinksnacks.
I have a report, Morath.
Duel extracted his head from the cage, then sealed the opening.
We have finished overhauling the Millennium Falcon. All identifying marks are removed, replaced with fake serial numbers. We made a few other modifications in addition to the regular repairs it needed. With your permission, I'll have it flown up to the Garrison Moon, where it can be incorporated into our space navy.
Duel nodded.
Good, good. What about our work on the energy shield generators? I want them functional as soon as possible, just in case the New Republic comes after us.
Our engineers on the moon base think they can reroute the circuits so we won't need all the parts we're missing. Kessel will be impregnable before long.
Duel's single eye lit up with eagerness.
Have Han Solo and his Wookiee gone into the mines yet?
Skinksnacks tapped his fingertips together.
I've reserved an armored personnel transport and will make the delivery personally within the hour.
Kessel's landscape rushed beneath the armored transport. Han Solo could see only a narrow strip through the window slits in the prisoner's compartment. He and Chewie had been strapped into their seats and linked to resistance feedback electrodes that would knock them unconscious if they struggled too much. Skinksnacks hunched over the pilot controls. An armored guard sat in the co-pilot seat, directing his blaster rifle toward them. The Scarecrow guided the transport around a huge open pit that plunged deep into the ground. Rusted girders and support structures stood like skeletal fingers propped up in the whitish barrens. Skinksnacks set the prisoner transport down on the rocky ground and fitted a breath mask over his nose and mouth. He gave another mask to the guard. What about us?
You won't be out very long. A little lightheadedness will do you good.
Punching a button on the control panel, Skinksnacks released their restraints. When Skinksnacks opened the side door to the transport vehicle, Han felt oxygen being stolen from his lungs. He and Chewbacca stumbled out of the craft as Skinksnacks and the guard prodded them. At the rim of the crater, they found an elevator cage on tracks that plunged deep into the pit. Skinksnacks seemed to be moving with deliberate slowness. Unable to breathe, Han tried to hurry, stumbling into the elevator cage and gesturing Chewbacca after him.
A few years ago, we had the atmosphere factories running full tilt,
Skinksnacks said.
Duel figured it was a frivolous waste of energy.
The guard shut the wire mesh door, and the cage descended at a rapid clip until the window of sky shrank to a small spot of blue light high above. They saw openings into the rock wall sealed off with steel doors. At each level, a ring of light encircled the pit, but many of the illuminators had either burned out or been broken. Chewbacca hung onto the bars of the elevator, panting for air. Han slumped on the elevator floor. When the elevator abruptly stopped, the jolt slammed Han's head into the mesh. As he looked down through the open cage floor, he saw the pit continuing immeasurably far below them. Opening the gate of the elevator, they had access to one of the sealed metal doors. Skinksnacks cranked the hatch, and Han and Chewbacca staggered into a small tiled chamber. As soon as Skinksnacks sealed the door, glorious oxygen flooded the chamber. On the other side of the airlock was a large muster room filled with lethargic-looking workers ready to begin their shift in the spice mines. The muster room had been blasted out of solid rock, and a tall bank of bunks ran along one side of the room. An empty eating section with long tables took up the central area. A burly man strode up to meet them, keeping his eyes fixed on Skinksnacks. The man had a lumpy face, a lumpy chin covered with bristly black stubble, and lumpy arms as if his massive muscles had all been attached to the wrong places.
You brought me two more? Only two? Well, the Wookiee's worth three men, but I don't know about the other one. This doesn't take care of half the people I've lost.
Skinksnacks glowered at him.
Then stop losing people.
Skinksnacks nudged Han.
This is Boss Roke. He's in charge of breaking you. He gets extra points with Morath Dool to make your life miserable.
He doesn't seem to be doing a very good job of keeping track of his workers, Han said.
Roke flashed him a withering glare. Something's taking my men down in the deep tunnels. I've had two more missing since yesterday. They've vanished without a trace.
Han shrugged. Well, it's hard to get good help these days. Skinksnecks guarded Han and Chewbacca as they outfitted themselves in the mine uniform, thermal suits with breath masks attached. Once they were suited up, Skinksnecks left them to the tender mercies of Boss Roke.
Shift Alpha, ready for work detail.
Boss Roke bellowed, and dozens of weary people shuffled to squares painted on the floor. Roke pointed to two empty squares.
You two, positions 18 and 19, now.
The workers mounted breath masks on their faces. Han and Chewbacca followed suit.
A big metal door on the far side of the wall slid open to reveal an illuminated chamber 100 meters long, in which floated a centipede-like mine transport of little cars linked together by magnetic attractors.
At the signal, the workers took their seats on one of the floating mine cars. Boss Roke took a seat in the pilot car. Other guards were stationed evenly throughout the open tram. All the guards wore infrared goggles. Behind them, the metal door slammed shut. All the lights went out. Han and Chewie plunged into an absolute suffocating blackness, like a blanket of tar. It came to Han like a slap in the face, the realization that since Glitterstim's spice was photoactive, made potent in the presence of light, it obviously had to be mined in total darkness, or else it would be ruined. Total darkness. Han and Chewbacca would spend their days at hard labor in the mines without ever being able to see each other, or where they were, or what they were doing. Han had to blink his eyes just to make sure they were open instead of closed. Not that it made any difference. A shiver went down his back. Boss Roke had said that some unknown thing was preying on the workers. How could anyone run from it in complete darkness? He heard the faint, echoed breathing of someone behind a breath mask leaning closer.
Are you really from the outside? I haven't been above ground for years.
It was impossible to make out the characteristics of the voice, muffled as it was behind the breath mask. Nonetheless, Han pictured a skeletal old man with long, scraggly hair, tattered beard, and ragged clothes.
We're from out there.
I'm Kip. Kip Duran.
After a moment's hesitation, Han introduced himself and Chewbacca. Suspecting some kind of trap, he decided not to give too much information. Kip Duran seemed to sense this and talked about himself without asking too many prying questions.
You'll get to know everybody here. I've lived most of my life on Kessel. My parents were political prisoners, exiled on this planet when the Emperor started cracking down on civil unrest. Is it really true the Empire has fallen?
7 years ago, Kip.
Something was happening to the cars ahead. The front car split off. He could hear it echo with a diminishing swoosh down one of the side tunnels.
They're separating the mining teams, Kip said.
When the car stopped, the guard spoke.
Everybody out. Link up. March to the work area.
After a long walk in total darkness, they arrived at the actual spice mining area.
We have to go deep to get the good spice deposits,
Kip said.
Down here, the Glitterstim is fresh and fibrous, instead of old and powdery like in the higher mines.
Before Han could say anything else, a high-pitched, teeth-jarring hum pounded against the tunnel. Then, a skin of rock along the inner tunnel sloughed off. The guard had used an acoustic disruptor that penetrated only a few inches into the rock, crumbling it. Kneeling on the rubble-strewn floor, Kip showed Han and Chewbacca how to sort through the crushed rock, feeling with cold-numbed fingers through the broken pebbles and debris to pluck out strands of Glitterstim like tufts of hair or asbestos fiber. During a lull, Han felt a tingle go up his spine. His ears, now attuned as his primary sense, picked up a distant rustling. It sounded like a thousand whispering voices growing louder, picking up speed, like a hydro locomotive bulleting down a tube. A pearly glow seemed to seep out of the air.
What?
Shh, Kip answered. The prisoners had stopped working. A faint glittering dazzle, like a dense cloud of fireflies, shot through the tunnel, humming and chittering. Han ducked. Around him, he heard others also falling flat on the debris-covered floor.
The glowing thing shot down the hollow tube, rolling and roiling. It suddenly arced right and plunged straight into the solid rock, vanishing like a fish falling back into the dark pool. Behind them, along the curving lengths of the tunnel, tiny blue sparks flickered from the exposed spice that had been activated by the light source whizzing past. The blue sparks sputtered and flickered and quickly faded.
"What was that?"
Han shouted. He heard Kip panting beside him.
"Nobody knows. It's about the 15th one I've seen over the years. We call them bogeys. They've never hurt anybody, or so we think. But nobody knows what's grabbing those people down in the deep mines."
At the end of the day, the workers were taken back to the muster room. When the standard lights came back on, the blinding glare was enough to make Han crouch over as if someone had punched him in the gut. He shielded his eyes. He felt a hand on his back.
"It's okay, Han. Let your eyes get used to it. There's no hurry."
But Han was in a hurry to see what Kip Duran looked like. He kept blinking away tears and peering out. When he finally discerned Kip's form, he blinked again, this time in surprise.
"You're just a kid."
Han saw a dark-haired, tousle-headed teen. He had wide eyes surrounded by dark rims, and his skin was pale from years of living in the darkness of the spice mines. Kip was wiry and tough-looking.
"Don't worry," Kip said. "I do the best I can."
Luke Skywalker sat alone in the cramped storage module Gantoris had given him for sleeping accommodations. Never intended as a living area, the module had few comforts, a basin of filmy water and a cloth-covered mound of dirt for a bed. Luke had his lightsaber and all the powers he had learned from Jedi training, should he decide to escape, but he didn't want to leave, not until Gantoris agreed to come with him.
"Come with me."
Gantoris appeared in the square doorway. Without a word, Luke stood up and stepped outside.
"Where are we going?"
Gantoris handed him a woven pouch, then slung a similar one over his own shoulder.
"To get food."
Tossing his thick black braid behind him, he marched toward the geyser field. Luke followed across the rugged terrain, sidestepping the lime-encrusted network of geysers and steam vents.
"You must have heard something about the Order of the Jedi Knights."
Luke proceeded to tell the dark, silent man about his quest and how it had brought him to Eel Shah. He finished by asking Gantoris to join him. Gantoris looked at him with dark, unfathomable eyes.
"Empires and republics mean nothing to me. What have they cared for us before? My universe is here, on this world."
He stepped in front of the wide opening to a geyser and peered into its depths. The stink of rotten eggs wafted into the air. From his hip pouch, Gantoris withdrew a battered old data pad and consulted a column of numbers that looked to be some sort of timetable.
"Here, we will go inside the geyser and harvest."
"Harvest what?" Without answering, Gantoris lowered himself over the lip of the geyser hole. Luke shrugged off his Jedi cloak and left it beside the geyser rim, then followed the other man underground. The shaft was a narrow, winding chimney through porous rock, a pipeline for superheated water. Colorful mineral deposits sparkled white and tan and blue, powdery in his hand. Luke found plenty of footholds as he followed Gantoris into the honeycombed passages. The rock felt warm and slimy.
Gantoris worked his way into a side crevice. "What do you want me to do?"
In answer, Gantoris wedged himself deeper into a crack and shrugged the woven pouch off his shoulder.
"Look in the dark pockets, the ones protected from the scalding water."
Gantoris dug his fingers into a crevice, felt around, and pulled out a handful of rubbery tendrils.
"With the heat and the mineral deposits, the lichens have a rich growing ground. Takes a great deal of processing, but we can make something edible out of this."
Luke likewise removed his pouch and began to search in the cracks, probing with his prosthetic hand. He could read ominous intentions from Gantoris, but couldn't pinpoint them. The lichen wasn't difficult to find, and Luke quickly filled his pouch, crawling through narrow openings. Before long, he lost sight of Gantoris among the fissures.
"Gantoris!"
He heard no answer. Looking up the shaft of daylight poking through from the surface, Luke finally saw the man's silhouette nearly at the top. Gantoris scrambled up the jagged walls, climbing as fast as he could manage, leaving Luke behind. Luke sensed rather than heard the buildup of pressure deep within the planet.
the water table, heated against magma, coming to a boil, rising up, finding the most direct escape. Gantoris had carried his own timetable. The geysers must erupt at regular intervals. He intended to trap Luke underground, where he would be cooked by curtains of superheated steam. Luke hauled himself up, climbing fast. The heat increased around him, making it difficult to breathe. Then he ran out of time. He heard the explosion deep beneath him, the roar of a plume of boiling water rushing to the surface. Luke knew he had only one chance. As the jet of steam and deadly water blasted toward him, he gathered his strength, his concentration, and sprang straight up, hurling his body out of the geyser shaft. He shot out of the geyser chimney, flailing his arms as he dropped to the ground. He tucked his shoulder and rolled, striking with enough force to knock the breath from him. A second later, a wall of steam and superheated water belched from the geyser. Luke shielded his exposed flesh and waited for the blast to dwindle. The geyser eruption lasted several minutes. When Luke finally crawled to his knees, he saw Gantoris and the other people of Il-Shah walking toward him, their faces grim as usual. Gantoris crossed his arms over his chest and nodded.
"You passed my first test, Dark Man."
Luke sensed both eagerness and terror from the man.
"Now come and face your last trial."
It was like a religious procession. With Gantoris in the lead, the people of Il-Shah began a long march up the slope to the cracks of lava. Spires of lava rock jutted out of the hillside like rotten teeth. Gantoris did not slow his pace when the slope took a steep turn, but he stopped when they reached a sheltered opening in the volcano wall. Overhead, a pall of smoke and ash hung in the air.
"Follow me inside," Gantoris told Luke.
The others filed past, continuing along the rugged path. Luke stepped after him. He needed to earn Gantoris' respect, if not trust. In this circumstance, Gantoris was making all the rules. Gantoris strode confidently into the dense shadows of the narrow passage. A lava tube blasted through the side of the cone to ease pressure from an ancient eruption. The lava tube spread out, revealing a boiling lake of fire. Though the fissure opened to the sky and other openings let in gusting cross drafts, the chamber felt like an oven. Squinting through noxious gases belching from the lava, Luke saw other people waiting on the far side of the chamber, their faces turned toward him. Gantoris had to raise his voice over the growling sounds of the churning magma.
"Walk across the fire, Dark Man. If you reach the other side safely, I will allow you to teach me whatever you wish."
Without waiting for a reply, he disappeared back into the darkness of the lava tube. Luke stared after him for a moment, wondering if Gantoris could be serious. But then he noticed dark objects in the blaze of bright lava, hard stepping stones of denser rock that made a precarious path across the lake of fire. Stepping to the edge of the simmering lava, Luke peered up at the broken sky above him. Then he set his foot down on the first stepping stone. It supported his weight. He looked ahead, keeping focused on the opposite side. The gathered people kept watching. Luke moved to another step, then another. A tendril of euphoria began to rise within him. This wasn't as difficult as he had feared. Then the lava began to bubble and hiss more forcefully, gushing as something stirred below. Suddenly, a serpent-like creature burst above the surface, hissing like rocket fuel caught on fire. The fireworm had a triangular head and pointed ear tufts. Crystalline scales armored every inch of its body. Its wide eyes were jewels, glowing with a fire of their own. Insulated air intakes sucked in the hot atmosphere, filling bladders deep within the creature's core and making it rise to the surface of the lava pool, huge and fierce. As the fireworm rose and coiled above Luke, he knew he could never outrun the monster. He stopped and found secure footing and drew his lightsaber, igniting it. The green glow of his blade fought against the fiery orange of the lava chamber. The fireworm dove beneath the magma again, splashing molten rock into the air. Luke danced from stepping stone to stepping stone, trying to avoid the deadly firefall. He held his lightsaber in front of him. His every nerve was tuned, ready to respond, but he saw only the restless surface of the lava.
"Where are you?"
The fireworm's head exploded out of the lava on the other side, rearing up and plunging down to strike. Luke slashed with his humming green blade.
But when the lightsaber smashed against the mirrored armor plates, the glowing green edge refracted into 1,000 components, splitting and ricocheting around the chamber. Sparks showered all around him. The energy blade that could supposedly slice through anything broke only one small silicon armor plate. On the other side of the chamber, the people of Il-Shah ducked to escape the flying shards of green power. Luke knew he could not use the lightsaber against the monster again. The fireworm yowled in surprise more than pain, then dove for refuge under the lava. Luke crouched, trying to figure out what to do next. The fireworm would return any minute. He didn't know how much time he would have. Suddenly, the creature launched itself out of the lava, roaring and hissing and making horrible sounds. Luke turned, ready to die in battle. But now the monster had no interest in him at all. Gouts of acrid smoke poured from the chink in the silicon armor, where lava ate its way into the fireworm's body core. The creature writhed, spewing lava into the air. Molten rock devoured the fireworm's internal organs, killing it from the inside out. When the fiery rock burned through to the fireworm's inflated air bladders, the creature exploded. Splatters of hardening lava rained down. Luke managed to deflect most of the burning chunks with the force, but some scorched his back and shoulder. Most of the stepping stones had been washed away in the turmoil. Nothing but impassable lava remained between Luke and Gantoris. Without a doubt in his mind, still throbbing with the force after his battle against the fireworm, he closed his eyes. Luke walked across the lake of fire. He did not think about it. The lava refused to touch his feet. Only the force burned bright around him. When he reached safety, Gantoris stood before him, an expression of awe on his broad face.
I will abide by my promise. Teach me how to use this mysterious power within me.
Lando Calrissian, accompanied by 3PO and R2, flew aboard Lando's ship, the Lady Luck, to Umgul, where the droids' research had indicated there might be a potential Jedi. The blob racing stadium, where they expected to find the man called Timo, was a vast sinkhole, a circular pit in the rocky ground of a bluff. The Umgulian stadium management had carved thousands of seats, stalls, pits, and sockets out of the sloping rocky walls to accommodate all manner of bodily configurations. Lando had just told R2 to jack into the stadium computer to see if Timo had bought a ticket when an announcer's voice echoed around the arena.
Sentient beings of all genders, welcome to the galaxy-renowned blob races of Umgul. For this afternoon's event, we'll be running 14 thoroughbred racing blobs through a 12-point obstacle course that has been thoroughly inspected and certified by the Galactic Racing Commission.
Lando directed his attention to the rear of the playing field. Conveyor mechanisms raised the blob platforms to a high ramp, stopping in front of a gate that held the oozing blobs back from the launching slide. A loud electronic tone reverberated through the air like a bullet hitting a brass bell. Suddenly, the gates flew open. 14 syrupy masses tumbled and oozed pell-mell down the slides, striking the low walls and slithering as fast as they could to the bottom of the ramp. The blob showed a range of colors, primarily grayish-green, but laced with bright hues. One amethyst blob, number 11, had pulled a small lead by the time it hit the first obstacle, a tall metal screen with a wide mesh. Blob 11 hurled itself onto the mesh grid and began to push its entire self through, dribbling in 100 tiny segments out the other side, where it flowed its gelatinous mass back together again. At every obstacle, Blob 11 came out ahead. Lando was not surprised when R2 returned, bleeping with excitement.
Excuse me, sir, but R2 has located our man Timo. He's placed a very large bet on Blob 11. We can go see him now, if you wish.
Let's check it out. The little droid hummed downhill toward the lower levels of the sinkhole stadium, leading Lando and 3PO to where Timo was seated. Young and attractive, but with a fidgety, furtive look, he had a disreputable air. Though his blob was winning by a wide margin, he did not seem elated. He just sat and waited as if he already knew the outcome. Lando stepped up beside him and pulled out the small Imperial detector Leia had given him that would enable him to get a force reading of the man. Wedge Antilles had found the device during the cleanup of Coruscant. The Emperor's hunter teams had used it to seek out Jedi who were hiding during his great purge.
Lando slid two flat sheet crystal paddles into the palms of his hands, and before Timo realized what was happening, scanned him to confirm whether or not he had the bluish aura of a possible trainee for Luke's academy. Timo looked up, saw Lando holding something that might have been a weapon, saw the two droids, and panicked. He fled and was swallowed up in the surge of spectators.
Sir, aren't we going to follow him?
No. Lando shook his head. We've got a reading. Look. The power pack of the Imperial detector had reconstructed a holographic aura mapping of Timo. There was no bluish haze of Jedi potential. Nothing out of the ordinary. He's a fraud, he told 3PO.
Can you be certain, sir? Remember that the detector itself is extremely old and may not be completely reliable.
Lando gave the protocol droid a skeptical frown, but 3PO's argument did have some merit. Besides, Lando was enjoying himself on Umgul. All right, we'll check him out a little further. That night, Lando was relaxing in his spacious hotel accommodations, pleased that the New Republic would pick up the tab, when 3PO announced that R2, who had remained at the stadium, had discovered Timo sneaking around the blob corrals.
Let's go, Lando said. I didn't expect him to try again so soon, but now we've got him, whatever he's doing.
Back at the stadium, they crept through the entrance to the corral into a room lined with blob pens. Banks of about 20 small enclosures blocked Lando's line of sight in the shadowy room. Within each pen, a gelatinous blob burbled and vibrated as it rested. In the shadows of the far row of pens, Lando spotted Timo hunched over a cage, reaching inside, doing something to the blob in front of him. R2-D2 puttered down the walkway between the pens. Timo looked up, startled, but R2 carried a cleaning attachment. He whirred right past Timo, ignoring the man, just as a cleaning droid would do. Beside Lando, 3PO called out,
Sir, he just implanted a small object into the protoplasm of that blob.
Timo whirled and started to run through the shadows. Lando sprinted after him. The other man made for the archway exit as fast as he could move in the murkiness.
Timo! Hold it right there!
Timo turned to glance in Lando's direction, then put on a burst of reckless speed. At that moment, R2 scuttled out of the shadows, placing himself directly in the running man's path. Timo crashed into the droid, somersaulted into the air, and landed on his back.
What in the bleeping miasma's going on here?
A hirsute man who looked as if he had dressed hurriedly strode into the corral area.
I'm Slish Fondine, owner of these stables. You better tell me who you are and why you're here.
Lando realized with some surprise that he had nothing to hide. He told Fondine that they had caught Timo tampering with one of the blobs. Over by the blob's pen, 3PO called,
Sir, I've just found a near-microscopic electronic object inside this blob's protoplasm. Magnifying? It appears to be a micromotivator.
Lando suddenly understood what Timo had been doing. A micromotivator implanted in the blob could send out a powerful internal stimulus, provoke a frantic flight response in any creature. If tuned properly, the micromotivator could give a blob the speed born of absolute terror. Slish Fondine glared daggers at Timo.
That is vile blasphemy against the whole spirit of blob racing.
Timo squirmed.
I had to have the money. I had to get off planet before she gets here.
What are you talking about? Who is she?
The Duchess Mistal, of course. She clings to me every second. She blows in my ears. She won't let me out of her sight. I couldn't stand it anymore. I had to get away.
Lando and Fondine looked at each other without comprehension. 3PO stepped forward to translate.
R2 has run a check. The Duchess Mistal of Dagul has posted a 1,000,000 credit reward for the safe return of her lost consort. Apparently, he ran away from her.
Slish Fondine was ready to execute Timo for his crime of destroying the integrity of the sport of blob racing, but Lando tried to reason with him. If you were to execute him knowing he is the Duchess's missing consort, things could get very unpleasant between Umgul and your sister planet. Might even be cause for war.
Fondine sighed. We'll leave it up to the prisoner himself. Do you wish to be executed or returned to the Duchess Mistel?
Timo swallowed hard.
How long do I have to think about it?
It's not a trick question, Lando said. Timo sighed.
Can I at least be allowed to rest until she gets here? I'm going to need all my strength.
Standing on the top deck of the palace, Leia craned her neck and searched the hazy skies. Her children were coming home. They'd not set foot on Coruscant for nearly 2 years, but now they would be back to stay. She could be a real mother to them at last. Just after the birth of the twins, they'd been sequestered on a secret planet uncovered by Luke and Admiral Ackbar. They had established a heavily guarded base there, leaving Leia's trusted servant Winter behind to watch over the Jedi children. 3PO, who had returned to Coruscant with Lando and R2, stood next to Leia. He cupped his golden hands around his optical sensors as if it would help him focus better.
Oh, there it is, Mistress Leia. A shuttle is coming down.
The shuttle circled the former Imperial Palace, then activated its repulsor lifts to come down with a gentle sigh on the landing platform. The young twins stepped out side by side and waited at the top of the ramp. Leia stared at Jason and Jaina, both self-composed and dark-haired, with wide, avid eyes. Leia ran up the ramp, gathering the children in her arms. She sensed fear and reservation in them, and she realized with a pang that she was a virtual stranger to them. Winter had been their nanny for as long as they could remember. Leia had been just a visitor whenever she could find time in her duties. She promised herself that she would make it up to them.
"Where's Daddy?"
Jason asked. Anger at her husband for being absent went through Leia like a spear of ice.
"He's not here right now."
Winter finally worked her way back from the pilot compartment. Leia looked up at her white-haired friend and confidant, who, noticing Han's absence, raised her eyebrows. Her face was filled with questions, but she remained silent. Later that evening, after the children were asleep, Winter spoke bluntly.
"If it were anyone else on a mission like this, 2 days overdue and no contact for a week or so, you would be concerned, very concerned. With Han, you are making an assumption that he is just being irresponsible. What if something happened to him?"
"Ah, that's crazy."
Winter regarded her calmly. "Or are you just unwilling to show your concern because it would embarrass you?"
Boss Roque stood in the muster room with hands on his hips, giving the workers a lumpy, appraising smile.
"We lost another team yesterday. A guard and 4 workers down in the deep new tunnels. I need some volunteers to go down with me to the lower tunnels and take a look. And if I don't get volunteers, I'll pick them anyway."
Rather than give Roque the satisfaction of coercing him, Han stepped forward.
"I'll volunteer. Beats another day of getting dirt under my fingernails."
"I'll go along, too." Kip Doran stepped beside Han. Chewbacca questioned Han's sanity.
"What'd he say?"
Boss Roque asked Han.
"He's volunteering, too."
"One more volunteer."
Roque scanned the room.
"You, Claw."
He pointed to a former prison worker.
"Suit up. Let's go."
On the way down to the mine, Kip whispered through the breath mask.
"Okay, so tell me what we got ourselves into." "I have an idea. People have been disappearing off and on from the same place. What if they found a way to escape? This planet is honeycombed with entrances to the spice tunnels."
They plunged down and down, whipping around sharp corners. In the blackness, Han lost all conception of time. After a while, Boss Roque brought the vehicle to a stop and called for the prisoners to dismount. The guard noisily cocked his blaster rifle. Boss Roque rustled in his pack, withdrawing some piece of equipment. Han heard an electronic clicking and pinging sound. It was some sort of detector. Han strained his ears, listening to the tones change as Roque moved the scanner from side to side.
"Spice all around us, just as we thought, and the concentration seems even higher up ahead. Move forward."
It was Chlor. He screamed again, but the sound came from much deeper in the tunnel, as if something had yanked him away and fled, carrying him to a secret lair. Running back, Roque stumbled into Han. Han heard a pointy ticking sound, moving closer, skittering like many sharp legs that ended in stiletto claws.
Han heard a thud as rope was thrown to the ground. With a quick whisking sound, he was dragged away down the tunnel, still gurgling and crying out.
Run!
Han yelled. Chewbacca plowed like a demolition vehicle into the guard behind him. Kip followed the Wookiee and leapt over the fallen man, but Han stumbled on him, sprawling flat on the broken rocky floor. The guard scrambled to his knees and started thrashing and pummeling as if Han were the enemy. But Han, blinded and desperate, grabbed for something else. He snatched at the infrared goggles on the guard's face and pulled them free. Looking through the goggles, he could see the fleeing, brilliant shapes of Kip and Chewbacca. Running, monstrous feet came closer, like a patter of meteorites pelting the side of a ship. This time it was the guard. Han turned to watch him, but he saw nothing else in the blackness of the tunnel. No shape, no body heat from any creature. Nothing that was alive. The guard suddenly froze, as if a giant, invisible hand had grabbed him from behind. Then Han saw, to his horror, the silhouette of a long, spindly leg reaching around in front of the guard's waist, and another one clipped over his shoulder, totally black, like a cutout from the infrared form of the guard. The guard yanked at something, his blaster rifle. A brilliant lance erupted in the pitch darkness, illuminating the thing for a splinter of a heartbeat. Han saw what seemed to be a writhing mass of sharp twigs, a rat's nest of spindly legs and claws and fangs intermixed with eyes, many, many eyes. Then the creature absorbed all the light, plunging the tunnels back into opaque darkness. Through the goggles, Han saw the guard lifted high in the air, other shadows of the icicle legs wrapped around him. Han saw the man's infrared outline grow dim as he became as cold as his surroundings. The creature, whatever it was, must be draining or feeding on energy, on body heat, or anything it could find in the cold, empty tunnels. Han turned and ran, stumbling and tripping.
Keep running!
Han yelled once he could see the forms ahead. He made out a dim glow of warmth still radiating from the floating mine transport.
The car's right in front of you, Chewie. Get on it!
The Wookiee bumped into the metal side of the vehicle and, reaching over, grabbed Kit, hauling him into the seat of the car. Han heard the clacking, scrambling footsteps behind him again, charging down the tunnel. Han reached the floating car and leapt in.
Just punch return, Chewie. Hit anything.
Chewbacca hit the start button and the car pivoted on its axis to move back in the direction they had come. With a loud spang, something struck the back car, rocking it sideways and slamming it against the side wall of the tunnel. Sparks flew as it scraped along the rocks, but the vehicle continued to accelerate. The creature ceased chasing them. The darkness rolled ahead like a great black vacuum. Han knew they were automatically heading back to the muster room.
I agree. Chewie, this wasn't one of my smarter ideas.
Luke Skywalker showed Gantoris the wonders of the universe. He took his passenger into orbit in the modified shuttle, letting the man look down on the doomed planet of Eelshah. The too-close moon hung above the world like a raised fist against a curtain of stars. Igniting the shuttle's sublight engines, Luke soared into the blazing wonder of the Cauldron Nebula as Gantoris stared out the viewports into the chaotic glowing gases. During the uneventful trip to B-Spin, Luke began telling Gantoris about the Force, about the training the candidates would undergo at the proposed Jedi Academy. Reach out and feel your mind, feel your body, feel the universe surrounding you. The Force stretches around and through everything. Everything is a part of everything else. Now that he had agreed to come along, Gantoris seemed willing and even eager to understand the strange echoes and feelings that had touched his mind throughout his life. By the time Luke brought the shuttle out of hyperspace on an approach to B-Spin, he thought Gantoris might be overwhelmed with new sights, but the stern man gawked out the viewports like a child awed by the roiling gas planet where Lando Calrissian had once run Cloud City. The sight of the swirling planet suddenly brought back some of the greatest horrors in Luke's life. He squeezed his eyes shut as he felt the sting of those memories. Gantoris, in the passenger compartment behind him, bent forward.
Is something wrong? I just sensed a strong flow of emotions from you.
Luke opened his eyes and looked out at B-Spin again. He thought of Han kidnapped and frozen in carbonite for delivery to Jabba the Hutt. He thought of the duel with Darth Vader on the catwalks of Cloud City that had cost Luke his hand. And worst of all, he recalled Vader pronouncing his terrible message. Luke, I am your father. Luke shuddered, but he turned to look back into Gantoris' dark eyes. I have powerful memories of this place. Gantoris asked no further questions. Airborne mining installations rode Bespin's wind currents, floating automated refineries, storage tanks bobbing above the clouds, and facilities to scoop valuable gases from the cloud banks. Not all of these floating installations had proved profitable, though. The drifting colossus of Tabanopolis hung empty, a creaking ghost town in the sky.
Is that where we're going? Gantoris asked.
And we're going to wait for someone here. Luke brought the shuttle down on a primary landing deck that looked sturdy enough to support his ship. They emerged from the shuttle. The high wind gusting through the carcass of Tabanopolis made a moaning sound. The wind had a bitter chemical tang from trace gases wafting to higher altitudes. Rocks, black bird-like creatures with triangular heads, clustered in the open gaps of buildings. As Luke and Gantoris moved forward, the flying creatures rustled leathery wings and made croaking sounds. What now? Gantoris asked. Luke sighed and gathered some inflatable blankets and a sleep roll from the passenger shuttle's storage compartment. I have no way of knowing when Streen might come back, and I think we should try to get a good rest. Luke and Gantoris found shelter in the decaying buildings of Tabanopolis. Awash in a Jedi trance more restful than sleep, Luke kept a small window open in his mind. Gantoris surprised him.
Luke, I think someone's coming. I can sense it.
Luke was impressed that Gantoris had been able to sense the distant stranger. He used his own sense to focus on a black shape approaching across the skyscape of rising gases. He saw an amazing cluster of lashed-together platforms and bulbous tanks, held aloft by balloons and maneuvered with propellers that stuck out at all angles. The hodgepodge vehicle drifted toward them, riding the winds. Luke smiled at the bizarre construction, while Gantoris stared in awe. They could make out the silhouette of a single man standing at the helm as buffeting breezes rippled trim sails at the sides of the main platform. Streen, the gas prospector, was returning home. Luke and Gantoris made their way down to the landing platform to wait for him. As the collection of gas tanks, balloons, and flat walkways approached, Streen finally noticed them. Luke held onto the fiber chains and helped Streen secure his vessel. No one spoke. Luke sized him up. Streen was approaching old age, bearded with brown hair so intermingled with strands of gray that it had turned to a creamy color. His skin bore a leathery look, as if the rough winds and harsh open air had sucked something essential out of his flesh. Streen stepped onto the landing area.
Tabanopolis hasn't been inhabited for years. Why have you come here?
Luke stood tall and faced the man. We came to see you. Luke told Streen of his plans for an academy.
But why me?
Streen asked. Luke explained, as much for Gantoris as for Streen. There are many valuable substances dissolved in Bespin's atmosphere at various layers. The floating cities are huge mining operations that remain in place as they draw gas from below the cloud layers. But you are a cloud prospector. At certain times, some storm or a deep atmospheric upheaval will make a cloud of volatiles belch up waiting to be siphoned off. Bespin has computerized satellites to detect these outbursts and to dispatch company men. But you always get there first. You somehow know an upheaval is going to happen before it does. Luke squatted next to the hermit. Tell me, Strain, how do you know when a gas layer is going to rise? Strain blinked and fidgeted.
I just know. I always thought it was just luck.
Let me touch your forehead. When Strain did not move away, Luke tentatively reached out, brushing the man's temples. Suddenly, his body jerked backward as if it had been burned. Now I'm sure, Streen. You do have the talent. There's nothing to fear. But Streen still looked nervous.
If you teach me how to use this sense I have, can you also teach me how to switch it off?
I want to learn how not to feel the people around me, not to be bombarded by their moods and prying thoughts and sour ideas. I'd very much like to be a part of the human race again.
Luke clapped him on the shoulder. That much I can show you. The mine car roared through the tunnels in total blackness. Han had no choice but to trust the computer guidance system. He gripped the sides of the mine car with hands gone white from cold and terror. Each time they shot past a gaping side tunnel, he imagined noises of skittering legs and scythe-like claws reaching out to pluck them from the passing car.
Our course is taking us back to the muster room,
Kip said.
This could be our chance to escape.
Do you know any other way out of these tunnels?
I don't, but maybe I could find one.
Han fought to contain a sudden fit of shudders.
I don't know about you, but I'm in no mood to go wandering through dark tunnels, feeling for a way out, not with that thing chasing after us.
Before they could form some sort of alternative plan, the floating mine cars coasted to a halt in the long holding chamber. The door at the far end slammed shut behind them. With his infrared goggles, Han could see the activation controls on the wall next to an inner door. His hands trembled as he punched access for the muster room. Light flooded around them, and the three survivors staggered inside. Dazzled, Han cupped his fingers over his eyes and let the infrared goggles dangle on his neck. Finally, he could make out a tall, gangly form with dark hair and sunken eyes on a skull-like face.
Glad you're back, Solo.
Skinksnix drew the double blaster at his hip. Han wasted no time, shoving Chewbacca backward.
Back in, Chewie. We gotta get out of here.
He yanked Kip through the open doorway. Chewbacca lunged into the dark chamber where the floating mine cars waited.
Hey!
Skinksnix leapt across the muster room. Han sealed the door in his face, scrambling the lock mechanism.
Looks as though we're gonna try one of those other ways out, Kip.
Han punched up the computer guidance system and let the vehicle go on its automated course. The floating cars rushed through the half-open metal gate just as the door to the muster room melted open, spilling a wedge of light into the tunnel. From behind they heard shouts, other people climbing into waiting mine cars. Han leaned over the controls, but the repulsor lifts could go only so fast. The sound of another mine car came roaring up behind them. Han had three cars linked together, hauling three riders with only one engine. If Skinksnix and the others took one car each, they would travel faster. Han looked behind them with his infrared goggles and saw the glowing target of Skinksnix and two other piloted vehicles. In the cold darkness, his own body heat would be just as apparent to the pursuers. Chewbacca held on to Kip, pushing him down to safety in the second car. The Wookiee reached behind him, fumbling with the catch to the empty third car. Skinksnix and the two guards closed the gap. And Chewbacca decoupled the magnetic bearing from the third car. Suddenly released, the empty car slung out behind them, dropping toward the ground. Skinksnix cried out as he swerved up to avoid a collision. The other two guards both curved to the left, battering into each other, but somehow all three pursuers kept their balance. They roared after Han.
Nice try, Chewie.
Skinksnix pulled out his modified double blaster, powered it on, and fired. The phased double beam poured out, striking the ceiling of the tunnel ahead of Han. The explosion of heat and light blinded him through the infrared goggles. Somehow, Kip reacted with molten speed and yanked the floating car sideways. Ahead in the inky blackness, a sudden clump of pearlescent glitters sprang out of a bare rock wall, wavering in the air. Then the luminescence started traveling down the tunnel away from them, as if trying to outrun the approaching cars.
Another bogey!
Kip shouted. Their floating cars followed the bogey, closing the gap, but as they neared, the glowing thing accelerated, as if taunting them by whipping around curves just in front of them.
Uh-oh. I think I just figured out what course we're on. All this feels very familiar.
What? How can you tell?
The most recent set of destination coordinates in this navigation computer was programmed by Boss Roque. We're going back down to where that monster was.
In a long straight stretch of tunnel, Skinksnix fired his double blaster again. As if he could sense the blast coming, Kip rocked the car to one side as the intense pulsed bolt shot down the tube, passed through the bogey without harming it, and struck a distant wall. The impact blew open a huge aperture into another grotto. Seeing an escape, the bogey ducked through the new opening.
Put it on manual. Let me fly it, Kip said.
By now, their eyes had grown accustomed to the bogey's glow, and they could actually see where they were going. Han relinquished the controls. Without a moment's pause, Kip launched the car into the wide-open section of wall that led to an unknown maze. As they plunged into the new grotto, something long and fibrous stung Han's face like a sharp wire whipping past him. The bogey shot into the vast chamber, flying across the darkness to the far wall. Upon striking the rock face, though, it did not melt through and vanish as the first bogey had done days earlier. Instead, the glowing ball stuck on the rough rock surface. It glittered and spangled and pulsed as if struggling. Around the bogey in the glow, wide veins of spice fizzled blue as the illumination activated them. The light crackled and spread outward in a network along the wall. All of the spice in the chamber began to race around in long lines as the light increased in a chain reaction. The pattern looked familiar.
Like a web,
Han said. From behind them, Skinksnacks fired again in a long, continuous blast that missed them in the wide space. The powerful beam struck the ceiling of the chamber, making it erupt with hot, broken stone that poured down from the roof of the tunnel. The bogey stretched and struggled as parts of the spice web tore away in the avalanche, yanking portions of the glow with it. Then Han saw the monstrous creature rise up from its lair on the grotto floor. A huge spider made of blown glass, all sharp edges, with 100 legs and 1,000 eyes. The bristling legs moved in a blur as it clambered up the debris toward the glowing bogey struggling in the spice web. On the rocks below, tossed aside like wadded sheets of used paper, lay the crumpled forms of Boss Roque, Clore, and the guard, frozen solid and drained of every drop of their bodily energy. Skinksnacks and the pursuing guard roared into the grotto. The spider thing glowed a dull blue with electric arcs crawling up and down its needle-like limbs, as if the creature itself was made out of activated spice. Attracted to the approaching heat source, it reared up. Skinksnacks did not see it until he had driven his floating minecar nearly into the grappling hook claws. Skinksnacks tried to leap out of the doomed car, but the spider thing speared him with a sharp leg, raising his scarecrow body higher. With the last of his strength, Skinksnacks flailed his arms as his body grew cold. The multi-legged creature began to feed. Han saw an open passage in the ceiling and noticed a dim trickle of light coming from it.
Up there!
Kip plunged the car upward into the ceiling opening and suddenly came upon another network of tunnels. They raced upward. The distant daylight pierced through the jagged obstacles of the passage. The floating car burst into the thin open air of Kessel, where watery light blinded them like a supernova. Struggling to see, Han yanked off his goggles and took back the pilot controls. Off to their right, they saw the towering stack of an atmosphere factory gushing white steam and air vapor into the sky.
That way,
Kip said.
We'll be able to find a ship.
Good idea,
Han said. When Luke returned to Coruscant, he had a joyous reunion with Han and Leia's children, whom he had not seen for some time. But Leia herself looked very tired. It wasn't just the strain of combining diplomatic duties with being a mother. Something else deeply concerned her, but she hadn't said anything. Rather than pry, Luke tried to get Leia's mind off her troubles. Leia, I need your help in a couple of bureaucratic matters.
Sure, she smiled wryly at him.
What can I do?
I still need to contact Mara Jade and a handful of other possible candidates, but now that I have 2 trainees here and waiting, I've got to find a place where we can begin our Jedi studies, and I have to find it soon. I've spoken with Streen and Ganturis, and it's clear to me that Coruscant is not appropriate. Streen doesn't like to be around people. He's not going to be very comfortable anywhere in Imperial City. And there is some danger about what we might do. Who am I to be teaching all these Jedi potentials? I have no way of knowing what might trigger a disaster, like one of the Emperor's force storms. It would be better if we found someplace isolated.
Yes, I agree. I'll try to find you an appropriate place.
And while you're looking, Luke continued, we also need to relocate all of the people on Il Shah. There's only about 50 of them left on that outpost, but the planet is doomed. When I took Ganturis, I promised we would find a new home for the survivors. See what you can do. For a group of people that small, shouldn't be difficult, Leia answered. Any place sounds better than the planet they're leaving. Luke laughed. Or you could always have Han win another planet for them in a card game. She looked at him as if stung. He suddenly realized that it was Han she was worried about.
Just then Lando Calrissian burst into the room unannounced. Leia, I just heard that Han hasn't come back yet.
Both men looked at her. Leia sighed and sat down. Yes, Han is missing. He went off to Kessel about 2 weeks ago, but now he's 4 days late coming back. Yesterday I spoke to someone who seems to be in charge on Kessel, a Rybet named Morath Duel. He has no record of the Millennium Falcon. Duel suggested they might have gotten lost in the black hole cluster.
Not Han, Lando said, and not in the Falcon. He knows how to fly that thing almost as well as I do.
If Han is missing, why didn't you send out a formal search party? Luke asked. Think about it, Luke. If I mobilized an official force, I could create a galactic incident just when we're trying to get Kessel into the New Republic.
Well, we'll go look for him ourselves, Lando said.
Luke could tell by the way Leia's face brightened that this was what she intended to ask all along.
Han, Kip, and Chewbacca raced across the open spaces of the atmosphere factory's landing pad to a cargo shuttle, an old Imperial model with scarred armor and long planar wings that made it look like a mechanical flying fish. Han and Chewbacca had flown a similar Lambda-class shuttle on their guerrilla mission to Endor, but this model looked even older. Chewbacca opened the hatch and Han ducked inside, moving straight to the controls. The Wookiee clambered after him as four guards marched into view around the perimeter of the atmosphere stack. The guards marched on what was probably a routine patrol. Han hoped they were sleepwalking by now. He punched the start controls. With a merciful whine and hum, the engines ignited. Power surged through the shuttle. The guards fired blasters at the shuttle. Han heard the sizzling thumps as the beam struck, but the ship's armor could withstand attack from minor hand weapons.
Time to leave this party.
Chewbacca raised them off the ground, maneuvering the shuttle away from the other vehicles on the landing pad. Then Han took over the controls. Below, the guards ran around the perimeter to keep within firing range, but Han flew the shuttle beyond the reach of small weapons fire.
Well, so much for sneaking out of here. Now Morath Duel's gonna know we escaped.
As if on cue, the shuttle's radio crackled and they could hear Duel's croaking voice in the background.
Solo! Han Solo, can you hear me?
Why, it sounds like my old friend Morath Duel. How are you doing, buddy? I hope you feel better than your assistant, Skinksnacks.
Solo, you have caused me more grief than any other life form in the galaxy, including Jabba the Hutt. I should have squashed you when I had you in my office.
Han rolled his eyes. Well, you missed your chance, and I don't plan on giving you another one. You tell him, Chewie.
Han switched off the radio. Kip scrambled forward and grabbed the controls, activating the maneuvering rockets and making the shuttle lurch forward with enough force to slam Han and Chewbacca against their seats. Kip tumbled backward, unable to keep his balance in the acceleration.
What'd you do that for?
Han turned and glared at Kip. Chewbacca dragged Han back to the console. Just below them, the atmosphere shimmered and crinkled as an impenetrable ionized screen appeared, blanketing the planet.
They've got their energy shield operational.
The workers on Kessel's moon base had repaired the protective screen that blocked off the prison planet. If Kip hadn't punched their acceleration exactly when he did, they would have been sizzled in the bath of power or trapped beneath the shield, unable to escape. Han looked over his shoulder at Kip.
How did you know?
Kip picked himself up off the floor, shaking his head to clear his thoughts.
Never mind. You okay?
Yeah, just get us away from Kessel.
Kip turned to the side viewport and said, Here they come. The garrison on Kessel's moon spewed fighters, dozens of rejuvenated battlecraft, armored freighters, slim and heavily armed X-wings and TIE fighters. They roared through the wispy tail of atmosphere in Kessel's orbital wake.
Strap yourselves in. This is gonna be a hell of a ride.
Han reached for the controls, preparing to fight, then felt a boulder drop in his stomach.
What? His ship's unarmed.
He frantically scanned the console.
Nothing. Not a single laser. Not even a slingshot.
Kip held the back of Han's pilot chair.
He stole a supply ship, not a fighter. What did you expect?
Chewie, pump everything into our shields, and I mean everything, including life support. Boost shields until they're off the scale. We're going to have to outrun them.
What did he say?
Now, he said our shields are going to fail in about 2 minutes.
Kip bit his lip, then pointed out the front viewport.
Go there.
The maw.
Are you crazy?
Swirling clouds of gas looped into the bottomless pits of black holes, making space look like a tangled skein of incandescent yarn. Gravity waited to tear apart any ship that came too close. The enormous gravity wells of the maw made a maze of all the hyperspace and normal space paths through the cluster. Most of the routes were either dead ends or went right down the gullet of a black hole.
We'll never find the right course. It'd be suicide.
Kip gripped Han's shoulder.
I can show you the way.
How, kid?
Kip wore an embarrassed expression for a moment, then he spoke quickly.
Now, this is going to sound like a hokey old religion, but it works. An old woman who spent part of her sentence in the spice tunnels told me I had some sort of tremendous potential. She showed me how to use something called the power or the strength or something.
The force.
Han wanted to grab Kip and hug him.
Why didn't you say so?
The first of Kestrel's ships reached them and fired, looping overhead, then returning as if to ram them. The shape of the attacking freighter made Han's blood turn to water, and he stared in silent dismay for a full second before he managed to cry out,
That's the Millennium Falcon! That's my ship! That does it. Now I'm mad.
Chewie, at my order, drop shields and dump everything into thrust. Pump every last erg into our engines and take us straight into the maw.
As Gantoris entered Coruscant's projection room with Leia, he stared at the giant windows that filled the walls with broad vistas of Coruscant. The two of them were not really high enough for such a view, Leia knew. The projection room was actually a deep internal chamber, and the windows were high-resolution screens, displaying images from cameras mounted at the top of the Imperial Palace. She stepped to the control dais in the middle of the room and called up images she had compiled from the archives, records left over from old Republic surveys and the dossiers compiled during the Alliance occupation. The window screens flickered and the images changed, startling Gantoris. He whirled as the landscape suddenly showed a completely different planet. His eyes grew wide and panicked, as if Leia had just transported him across the galaxy.
I'm showing you a new home. This is Dantooine, the place we have chosen for the people of Ilshaw.
Around them, the window screens displayed vast plains of grassland and spiky trees. Purplish hills rolled across the distant horizon. A herd of small hairy beasts roamed across the savanna. In the air, a cluster of bright balloon-like things, either plants or rudimentary animals, drifted about. A few had snagged on pointed branches of the spiky trees. Two moons, one lavender and one greenish, soared overhead. Leia had used Dantooine as a decoy when Grand Moff Tarkin interrogated her aboard the Death Star. To save her beloved planet of Alderaan, she had divulged the location of the old rebel base on Dantooine, rather than naming the real base on Yavin 4. But Tarkin destroyed Alderaan anyway, because Dantooine was too remote for an effective demonstration of the Death Star's power. Now, though, Dantooine could be put to use again, as a home for the refugees of Ilshaw. Do you think your people would like to live on a place like this? Gantoris nodded.
This looks like a paradise. If these are representative pictures, this place Dantooine will be a perfect new home for my people.
The stolen shuttle plummeted into the maw. Maelstroms of hot gas buffeted them from side to side as Kip fought to maintain their tenuous course. The maw was one of the wonders of the galaxy. The very existence of a black hole cluster seemed astrophysically impossible and had led to much conjecture about its origin. Old Republic scientists cited probability arguments that among the near infinite stars in the universe, something like the maw had to occur at least once. Others speculated that the maw had actually been built, assembled by a powerful ancient race that had created the black holes in a barely stable configuration,
to open gateways into new dimensions. At the moment, Han Solo cared only that the Maw was likely to be the cause of his death. The shuttle's interior was dark and hot and stuffy. The wild colors and blazing light made psychedelic fireworks outside the ship and weird shadows inside. All lighting, life support, and temperature regulation had been shut down to increase power to the failing shields. Han sweated in the rear passenger seat, watching the controls he had relinquished to Kip. Though he had been fighting for his life almost constantly during the past week, he missed Leia very much. Han hated to know that his children had finally returned from their sanctuary planet, and he hadn't been there to greet them. And he would never see any of them again if Kip Duron's mysterious abilities failed to steer them through the Maw. Kip struggled with the controls, flying the shuttle with some of the most delicate, most difficult maneuvers Han had ever seen, and Kip kept his eyes closed. The young man seemed to be seeing through a different set of eyes, looking at some path not apparent with normal vision. Staring at the deadly black holes all around the shuttle, Han wanted to close his own eyes, too. Sparks flew on one of the far control panels as a shield gave out. Chewbacca jammed long fingers down on the controls, rerouting and spreading the remaining protection evenly around them. If a single gap appeared in the shields, the X-rays and fiery gases would tear them apart. Kip didn't flinch. Coming up on the end of this ride, there's a gravitationally safe island in the middle of the cluster, like the eye of a storm. Han felt relief rush through him. We'd better hide there for a while, recharge the power sources, and make a few quick and dirty repairs. The swirling ionized gases parted like a curtain thrown aside to reveal the gravitational oasis in the cluster's core, a safe haven for them to recuperate before returning to Coruscant.
Made it,
Han said in a whisper. But someone else had already found the hiding place. Orbiting a small rocky island in the center of the Maw hung four gigantic Imperial Star Destroyers, bristling with weaponry. Within a moment of their arrival, swarms of TIE fighters poured out of the Star Destroyer hangar bays in a truly impressive show of force. The comm crackled. Gruff words spilled out of the speakers.
Imperial Shuttle, welcome. It's been a long time since we've received word from the outside. Please provide your security access code. Our TIE squadron is coming to escort you.
Han stiffened, remembering that they had indeed stolen an old Imperial shuttle, but a security access code. He had to think fast. He toggled the transmitter switch.
This is Imperial Shuttle Endor coming in. We've had a rough ride through the Maw, and...
Improper response.
What a surprise.
You have obviously not been sent by Grand Moff Tarkin. Shuttle Endor, you are to be taken prisoner immediately and brought aboard Imperial Star Destroyer Gorgon for deep interrogation. Any resistance will result in your being destroyed.
Han wondered if he should bother to acknowledge, then decided against it. He was puzzled by the mention of Grand Moff Tarkin, the brutal governor who had built the first Death Star. Tarkin had been destroyed along with his doomsday weapon 10 years before. Could these people have been out of touch for that long? The shuttle lurched as if a giant invisible hand had grabbed it. Han could hear the metal plates groaning as pressure constricted the outer hull. It's a tractor beam, Han said. The Star Destroyer Gorgon opened its huge receiving bay to swallow the prisoners. The tractor beam lifted the shuttle into the Gorgon's bay and hauled it over to an isolated landing area. Armed stormtroopers hustled into position. Chewbacca, the most intimidating, took the central position, while Han and Kip Duran flanked him. They walked out and surrendered. Doors at the rear of the landing bay slid open, and a tall woman strode through, accompanied by a bodyguard on each side. She wore an olive-gray jumpsuit and black gloves. She marched forward, paying little attention to those around her. She fastened her gaze on the prisoners. Her most striking feature was her waist-length hair, which was the color of hot copper and seemed to crackle with an electric life of its own. Her features were as finely carved and as rigid as a statue's. Her lips barely moved as she spoke. I'm Admiral Dalla, in charge of the fleet guarding Maw installation. She flashed her green-eyed glance at each of them in turn.
You three are in a lot of trouble.
Lando Calrissian piloted the Lady Luck toward Kessel.
Welcome to the garden spot of the galaxy,
he said to Luke. Luke thought of his home planet of Tatooine, the Dune Sea, the great pit of Carcoon, the Yundland wastes.
I've seen worse, he said.
R2 agreed. Lando opened a comm channel.
Hello, Kessel. Anybody listening? I'm looking for someone named Morrith Duel.
Who is this? Identify yourself.
Our name's Timo. My associate and I recently hit it big at the Umgulian Bob races, and we have some money to dispose of. 500,000 credits, to be exact. So run along and fetch Duel.
Before leaving Coruscant, they had doctored up false personal backgrounds for themselves, removing any mention of the New Republic, but keeping enough hints at shady dealings and fast transactions to provide corroborating evidence. Another voice broke out of the speakers.
Mr. Timo, this is Morris Duel. 500,000 credits is certainly worth talking about. I'll send a flyer escort for you.
Morrith Duel met them in one of the corridors of the Imperial Correction Facility.
Welcome, Mr. Timo. Let me apologize for our turmoil here. Yesterday I lost my right-hand man and my primary shift boss in a tunnel mishap. Please excuse me if I seem a bit flustered.
Quite all right, Lando gestured to Luke. My associate is here to help me check out the details of spice mining and to advise me on its potential as an investment. I know I must have taken you by surprise. Tell me, is there any part of your operation I might invest in?
Duel motioned for them to follow. When they were seated inside his office, he rubbed his hands.
It just so happens that just before his demise, our shift boss uncovered an exceptionally rich deposit of glitterstim spice. It'll take a good amount of money and effort to make repairs in the collapsed tunnel, but the payoff can be greater than your wildest dreams.
I'd like to see all aspects of your spice mining and production. Let us observe firsthand how the business works.
Obviously reluctant to show them around, but afraid to do anything that could result in the loss of a great deal of money, Duel stood up, beaming.
All right. I understand your concerns, Mr. Timo. Come, I'll show you the spice processing line, and then we'll arrange a tour of the newly opened tunnels.
In the wide grotto, where part of the mine ceiling had fallen in, wan light spilled down, illuminating the open areas. Workers had strung lights around the perimeter as they hammered and hauled broken rock.
What's that thing?
From his seat in a mine car, Lando pointed to the other side of the grotto. Buried under a pile of jagged rubble, dozens of glassy, spear-like legs protruded at all angles. Falling chunks of rock had crushed it, and the creature's whip-like legs lay askew as if it had tried to flail the boulders aside. Duel strutted over to the carcass.
That, my friend, seems to be the thing that creates the spice itself. It's the first such creature we've encountered, but there must be others deep in the tunnels. We're getting a xenobiologist to study it. The bulk of its body seems to be made of glitterstim itself, and the strands we pull from the tunnel walls are what it uses as a web.
A guard joined them. He nudged one of the sharp crystalline legs with his boot.
We want to see if we can extract raw glitterstim from the web sack and spinnerets in the dead body.
Duel bobbed his head up and down.
Wouldn't that be something? Absolutely pure glitterstim.
Lando nodded noncommittally. Luke, playing his part, fished around for more information.
So, how does this affect your safety record? Did this creature prey on any of the miners?
Yes, it killed several, including the shift boss and my assistant. How many bodies have you found so far?
Duel asked the guard.
Three fresh ones and two old ones, and we think it killed a bunch more. There's a big Wookiee and some other prisoners still unaccounted for.
Duel scowled at the guard, but quickly regained his false smile. Luke felt cold upon hearing the news. quarters on an Imperial-class Star Destroyer were spacious and functional, and they had been Dalla's only home for more than a decade. Year after year, she operated in a vacuum, alone as always, following Tarkin's parting instructions with no further input from the Grand Moff. Her fleet had been isolated, and the crew on her four Star Destroyers had fallen into a routine, but Dalla did not relax her grip. She was afraid to wonder about events outside in the galaxy, confident at least that she could count on the Empire with its unbending rules, sometimes cruel, but always clear-cut. Everything had been cut and dried before the interrogation of the new prisoners. Dalla punched up the recording and watched it again, though she had already replayed the sequence a dozen times. The man, Han Solo, sat strapped in a convoluted chair with steel tubes and wires and piping tangled around him. The gadgetry looked sharp and ominous. Most of it served no purpose other than to increase the prisoner's terror, and in that it proved effective. On the recording, Dalla stood by Commander Kratos, the captain of her flagship, the Gorgon. "Tell us where you come from," she was saying. "Is the Rebel Alliance crushed yet? What has happened in the Empire?" "Go kiss a hut," Solo snapped. Dalla stared woodenly at him for a moment, then shrugged, nodding to Kratos. The commander punched a control pad, and one of the metal bars across the restraining chair hummed. The muscles in Solo's left thigh began to spasm, jittering. His leg bounced up and down. The seizures were not painful so much as they were maddening. Dalla had found that a most effective interrogation technique was simply to induce an unrelenting facial tic that made the eyes blink over and over and over again for hours without end.
"Tell us about the Empire." "Empire's in the garbage, Masher."
Dalla could see the whites of his eyes as Solo tried to look down at his rebellious leg muscles.
The Emperor's dead. He died in the explosion of the second Death Star."
Dalla and Kratos both snapped their heads up.
"Second Death Star? Tell me about it." "No."
Kratos adjusted another button. The bars in the labyrinthine chair hummed, and Solo's right hand began twitching, his fingers scrabbling against the smooth metal, jittering and shaking.
"The second Death Star? It was still under construction when we set off a chain reaction in its core. Darth Vader and the Emperor were on board."
Solo resisted, but he seemed to delight in telling the news.
"And what happened to the first Death Star?"
Solo grinned.
"The rebels blew it up, too." "And what about Grand Moff Tarkin?" "He's in a billion atoms scattered across the Yavin system. He burned with his Death Star."
Gradually, the prisoner spilled the entire story of the other battles, the Civil War, Grand Admiral Thrawn, the resurrected Emperor, the truce at Bakura, the terrible conflicts in which the waning Empire had been defeated again and again. Until, finally, she had Kratos release him. Later, after the interrogator droid had run tests, she found out that Solo was indeed telling the truth. Alone in her quarters, Admiral Dalla switched off the recording. Her head pounded with annoying ache. One of the Maw installation scientists, learning that the new prisoner had actually been on board the completed Death Star, had demanded to be allowed on the Gorgon to speak with him. Right now, Dalla had greater worries. She had to decide what to do with this new information. Dalla took an Imperial shuttle and set off to see her chief scientist, Tol Sivron. Below her hung the Maw installation, a cluster of planetoids crammed at the exact center of the gravitational island. Immense bridges and bands held the asteroids in place. Access tubes and transit rails connected the cluster of drifting rocks. Under Grand Moff Tarkin's direction, Imperial constructors had ferried the rocks across space and through the obstacle course into the Maw. The insides of the asteroids were hollowed out into habitation chambers, laboratory areas, prototype assembly bays, and meeting halls. Dalla had read a draft of the communique Tarkin had sent to the Emperor, urging the creation of superweapons.
"If we present the citizen with an absolutely invincible weapon, that shall become the symbol for the Empire. We may need only a handful of these weapons to subjugate thousands of worlds, each containing millions upon millions of beings. Such a weapon must have force great enough to dispatch an entire system. And the fear it shall inspire will be great enough for you to rule the galaxy unchallenged.
After getting permission for his scheme, Tarkin had used his new authority as Grand Moff to put together this super-secret think tank installation, where he could isolate the most brilliant scientists and theoreticians, giving them orders to develop new weapons for the Emperor. The installation was so secret that the Emperor himself did not know of its existence, and after the place was built, the workers and architects were eliminated. The secret of Maw installation had been protected. After Tol Sivron and his teams proved the initial concept of the Death Star, Grand Moff Tarkin had taken one of the installation's top scientists to the Outer Rim to oversee actual construction of the first production model Death Star. Tarkin's last words to the Maw scientists had been a challenge.
Good. Now create an even more powerful weapon. The Death Star is terrible. Think of something worse. That is your reason for existence.
Tarkin gave them 9 years to develop his next-generation ultimate weapon. And now, since Tarkin was dead, and no one else knew Maw installation even existed, Darla could make her own decisions, plan her own course of action. Reaching the small gravity field of the central administrative asteroid, Darla secured her shuttle in the docking bay. After marshaling a retinue of stormtroopers, she strode purposefully through the anterooms and into the scientist administrator's office.
Tol Sivron was a Twi'lek, pasty-faced and hairless, with two whip-like head tails that dangled from his skull.
The tentacles fell over his shoulders like two skinless blood eels sucking the back of his cranium.
Twi'leks were generally a disreputable lot, slinking around with smugglers and acting as henchmen for crime lords like Jabba the Hutt. Though Darla rarely questioned Grand Moff Tarkin's decisions, she didn't understand how Tol Sivron had obtained his position here. She told him what she had learned from the rebel prisoner Solo.
We may need to pump them for further information before we decide what to do next.
Sivron blinked his piggish eyes.
What to do? What do you mean? What is there to do?
She crossed her arms over her chest.
We can take the new Star Crusher and destroy the New Republic system by system.
The Twi'lek squirmed.
But the Star Crusher isn't finished yet. We still have tests to run, reports to file.
You have been procrastinating for 2 years. You are behind schedule, thanks to your ineptness. Grand Moff Tarkin is not coming back, and you no longer have an excuse to delay. I need the weapon now, and I'm going to take it.
When Han came to, he was chained to a column, and he remembered little except that he had undergone a painful interrogation. He found himself in a spacious room, some kind of laboratory or analysis center. He heard singing and the sound of flutes. He turned his head to see a willowy alien woman standing in front of a device that seemed to be a combination musical keyboard and data entry pad. She hummed a complex string of notes as her fingers played on the musical keys. In front of her, a rotating blueprint of a three-dimensional triangular shape took form. He meant to say, "Who are you?" but his lips and vocal cords would not cooperate. Instead, he said, Startled, the female alien fluttered her slender hands around the 3D geometrical image. Then she pranced over to where Han lay. She was an attractive humanoid, tall and slender, with a bluish tint to her skin. Her gossamer hair seemed like strands of pearlescent feathers. Her eyes were wide and deep blue, carrying an expression of perpetual astonishment.
I've been waiting for you to wake up. I have so many questions to ask you. Is it true that you actually set foot on the first Death Star? And you got a look at the second one while it was under construction? Tell me what it was like. Anything you can remember. Every detail would be like a treasure trove to me.
He worked his mouth, trying to form words again.
Who are you?
The alien woman touched her badge with one of her long-fingered hands.
My name is Kwee-Zoox, and I know that you are Han Solo. I've read the hard copy of the debriefing you gave Admiral Darla.
Debriefing? Did she mean the torture chair? Kwee-Zook's entire demeanor seemed superficial and distracted, as if she were paying only a small amount of attention to details, while she was preoccupied with something else.
Now then, please tell me about the Death Star. What did it sound like? What did it feel like when you walked down the corridors? Tell me everything you can remember.
She wrung her hands in barely restrained excitement.
No.
His response apparently shocked Kui enough that she took a step backward and let out a startled musical squawk.
You have to. Information is for everyone. We build on the knowledge we have, add to it, and leave a greater legacy for our successors.
Kui struck him as impossibly naive. Han wondered how long she had been sheltered in the middle of the black hole cluster.
All right, then. Tell me where my friends are. I came in here with a young man and a Wookiee. Share that information with me, and I'll see what I can remember about the Death Star.
Kui glanced toward the door as if contemplating whether to summon the stormtroopers after all.
It is in my charter here as a researcher that I have access to all the data I need. Why won't you answer my few simple questions?
Why won't you answer mine? I never signed your charter. I'm under no obligation to you.
Han waited, fixing his eyes on her as she fidgeted. Finally, Kui pulled out her datapad and hummed as she keyed in a request. She looked at him, her deep blue eyes blinking rapidly.
Your Wookiee companion has been assigned to a labor detail in the engine maintenance sector. Someone named Kip Duron is still in the detention area, high security. Now, tell me about the Death Star.
Han rolled his eyes, but saw no reason not to.
The Death Star had been destroyed long ago, and the plans were safely locked inside the protected data core of the former Imperial Information Center. Han told Kui about the corridors, the noises. He knew the most about the hangar bay, the detention area, and the garbage masher, but she didn't seem interested in those details.
Why are you so interested in all this, anyway? She blinked her eyes.
Because I designed the Death Star.
Kip Duron felt like an animal trapped in a cage. He stared at the dull, confining walls of the detention cell. He remembered the shrunken and leprous face of the old woman, Vima Dabada, who had spoken to him of the Force. She had a habit of huddling in corners, of pulling shadows around herself as if to hide from immense prying eyes. The fallen Jedi had a guilty conscience that suffocated her like a blanket, but she had taken the time to teach Kip a few things before the Imperials whisked her away.
You have great potential,
she had told him in one of her last brief lessons. Kip had paid little attention to that until now. He stared fixedly at his untouched meal. Perhaps if he concentrated, focused his abilities on manipulating something, moving a tiny object, he could turn that skill into an escape. But now that he needed to make use of the Force, he didn't know where to begin. He was not certain how he did what he did. His parents had no special sort of powers. On the Dire colony of the Anowit system, they had both been outspoken local politicians. Kip remembered that night of terror when the stormtroopers had marched into the living quarters, kicked over the furniture. The stormtrooper captain read an arrest order, accusing Kip's parents of treason. Then the stormtroopers drew their blasters and stunned the two astonished adults. Kip's older brother Zeth had tried to protect him, so the troopers stunned him as well. Kip had been only 8 years old at the time. Kip and his parents were taken to Kessel, while 14-year-old Zeth was hauled off as a brainwashed recruit to the Imperial Military Academy in Kurita. They never heard from him again. Kip's parents had died during the prison revolt on Kessel. Kip had rotted in the darkness of the tunnels for 8 years. Now he had escaped, only to be captured by the Imperials again. Somehow, the Imperials were always there to wreck his aspirations. Kip's anger focused on his meal tray. He pushed on it, trying to bend it. Had the tray moved, jerked a little? Perhaps anger was the key to focusing his latent energies. He concentrated on the walls, on his narrow surroundings. He had to find some way of escaping. Han had already proved that it could be done. Kip vowed that if he did manage to get away, he would find someone to teach him how to use these mysterious powers. He never wanted to be left so helpless again. Looking at the delicate bird like Kwee-Zooks, Han could not imagine her as the developer of the Death Star. What's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this?
This is what I do. This is what I'm best at.
Kwee nodded her head absently as if considering her answer.
Here, I have a chance to grapple with the greatest mysteries of the cosmos, to solve problems that others have claimed are unsolvable, to see my wild ideas take shape. It's very thrilling. One of our concepts was for autonomous world devastators that could strip raw materials from a planet's surface, feed them into huge automated onboard factories, and produce useful machines. We're quite proud of that concept. We transmitted the proposal off to Tarkin shortly after he left. I wonder what ever happened to that idea.
Han blinked in astonishment. The terrifying fleet of world devastators had attacked Admiral Akbar's home planet, laying waste part of the beautiful water world before they were destroyed. The world devastators have already been built, put to very efficient use.
Kwee's face lit up. Oh, that's wonderful.
No, it isn't,
he shouted into her face. She sprang back.
Don't you know what your inventions are used for? Do you have any idea?
Kwee straightened up again defensively.
Yes, of course. The Death Star was to be used to break up dead planets to allow direct mining of the heavy metals trapped in the core. The world devastators would be autonomous factories, combing asteroids or sterile worlds to produce a wide range of items without polluting inhabited planets.
Han snorted and rolled his eyes.
If you believe that, you'll believe anything. The Death Star's first target was the planet Alderaan, my wife's home world. It murdered millions of innocent people. The world devastators were turned loose on the inhabited world of Calamari. Hundreds of thousands died.
I don't believe you.
I was there. I flew through the rubble of Alderaan. I saw the devastation on Calamari. Didn't you read about it in my interrogation report?
No, that wasn't in your debriefing summary, which you so melodramatically call an interrogation.
Yeah, well, then you didn't get the whole report.
Nonsense. I'm entitled to all data. Besides, I only develop the concepts. I make them work. If someone on the outside abuses my inventions, I can't be held responsible.
Kwee flitted back to her 3D display panel, tapping on the musical keys and humming to sharpen the long, angular image she had been constructing.
Would you like to see what I'm working on now?
Sure, Han said, afraid that when she no longer needed to talk to him, Kwee would send him back to his detention cell. She gestured to the image of a small craft. Four-sided and elongated, it looked like the long shard of a fire-facet gem. From the diagram, he could see a pilot's compartment with space enough for six people. Small lasers studded strategic areas. The bottom of the long point carried a strange toroidal transmitting dish.
Right now, we're working on enhancing the armor. Though the craft is not much larger than a single-man fighter, we need it to be completely impervious to attack.
And what is it? What does it do?
Kwee looked at the image with awe, pride, and fear. Well, we haven't actually tested it yet, but the first full-scale model is basically completed. We call this concept the Sun Crusher. Tiny, but immensely powerful. One small, impervious craft launches a modulated resonance projectile into a star, which triggers a chain reaction in the core, igniting a supernova even in low-mass stars. Straightforward and simple.
In his horror, Han could think of nothing to say. The Death Star destroyed planets, but the Sun Crusher could destroy whole solar systems. Kessel's landscape rushed beneath the armored transport. Han Solo could see only a narrow strip through the window slits in the prisoner's compartment. He and Chewie had been strapped into their seats and linked to resistance feedback electrodes that would knock them unconscious if they struggled too much. Skink's necks hunched over the pilot controls. An armored guard sat in the co-pilot's seat, directing his blaster rifle toward them. The Scarecrow guided the transport around a huge open pit that plunged deep into the ground. Rusted girders and support structures stood like skeletal fingers propped up in the whitish barrens.
Skinksnick set the prisoner transport down on the rocky ground and fitted a breath mask over his nose and mouth. He gave another mask to the guard. What about us?
You won't be out very long. A little lightheadedness will do you good.
Punching a button on the control panel, Skinksnecks released their restraints. When Skinksnecks opened the side door to the transport vehicle, Han felt oxygen being stolen from his lungs. He and Chewbacca stumbled out of the craft as Skinksnecks and the guard prodded them. At the rim of the crater, they found an elevator cage on tracks that plunged deep into the pit. Skinksnecks seemed to be moving with deliberate slowness. Unable to breathe, Han tried to hurry, stumbling into the elevator cage and gesturing Chewbacca after him.
A few years ago, we had the atmosphere factories running full tilt,
Skinksnecks said.
Duel figured it was a frivolous waste of energy.
The guard shut the wire mesh door, and the cage descended at a rapid clip until the window of sky shrank to a small spot of blue light high above. They saw openings into the rock wall sealed off with steel doors. At each level, a ring of light encircled the pit, but many of the illuminators had either burned out or been broken. Chewbacca hung onto the bars of the elevator, panting for air. Han slumped on the elevator floor. When the elevator abruptly stopped, the jolt slammed Han's head into the mesh. As he looked down through the open cage floor, he saw the pit continuing immeasurably far below them. Opening the gate of the elevator, they had access to one of the sealed metal doors. Skinksnecks cranked the hatch, and Han and Chewbacca staggered into a small tiled chamber. As soon as Skinksnecks sealed the door, glorious oxygen flooded the chamber. On the other side of the airlock was a large muster room filled with lethargic-looking workers ready to begin their shift in the spice mines. The muster room had been blasted out of solid rock, and a tall bank of bunks ran along one side of the room. An empty eating section with long tables took up the central area. A burly man strode up to meet them, keeping his eyes fixed on Skinksnecks. The man had a lumpy face, a lumpy chin covered with bristly black stubble, and lumpy arms, as if his massive muscles had all been attached to the wrong places.
You brought me two more? Only two? Well, the Wookiee's worth three men, but I don't know about the other one. This doesn't take care of half the people I've lost.
Skinksnecks glowered at him.
Then stop losing people.
Skinksnecks nudged Han.
This is Boss Roke. He's in charge of breaking you. He gets extra points with Morath Duel to make your life miserable.
He doesn't seem to be doing a very good job of keeping track of his workers, Han said.
Roke flashed him a withering glare.
Something's taking my men down in the deep tunnels. I've had two more missing since yesterday. They've vanished without a trace.
Han shrugged. Well, it's hard to get good help these days. Skinksnecks guarded Han and Chewbacca as they outfitted themselves in the mine uniform, thermal suits with breath masks attached. Once they were suited up, Skinksnecks left them to the tender mercies of Boss Roke.
Shift Alpha. Ready for work, detail.
Boss Roke bellowed, and dozens of weary people shuffled to squares painted on the floor. Roke pointed to two empty squares.
You two, positions 18 and 19, now.
The workers mounted breath masks on their faces. Han and Chewbacca followed suit. A big metal door on the far side of the wall slid open to reveal an illuminated chamber 100 meters long, in which floated a centipede-like mine transport of little cars linked together by magnetic attractors. At the signal, the workers took their seats on one of the floating mine cars. Boss Roke took a seat in the pilot car. Other guards were stationed evenly throughout the open tram. All the guards wore infrared goggles. Behind them, the metal door slammed shut. All the lights went out. Han and Chewie plunged into an absolute suffocating blackness, like a blanket of tar. It came to Han like a slap in the face, the realization that since Glitterstim's spice was photoactive, made potent in the presence of light, it obviously had to be mined in total darkness, or else it would be ruined. Total darkness. Han and Chewbacca would spend their days at hard labor in the mines without ever being able to see each other, or where they were, or what they were doing. Han had to blink his eyes just to make sure they were open instead of closed. Not that it made any difference. A shiver went down his back. Boss Roke had said that some unknown thing was preying on the workers. How could anyone run from it in complete darkness?
He heard the faint, echoed breathing of someone behind a breath mask leaning closer.
Are you really from the outside? I haven't been above ground for years.
It was impossible to make out the characteristics of the voice, muffled as it was behind the breath mask. Nonetheless, Han pictured a skeletal old man with long, scraggly hair, tattered beard, and ragged clothes.
We're from out there.
I'm Kip. Kip Duran.
After a moment's hesitation, Han introduced himself and Chewbacca. Suspecting some kind of trap, he decided not to give too much information. Kip Duran seemed to sense this and talked about himself without asking too many prying questions.
You'll get to know everybody here. I've lived most of my life on Kessel. My parents were political prisoners, exiled on this planet when the Emperor started cracking down on civil unrest. Is it really true the Empire has fallen?
7 years ago, Kip.
Something was happening to the cars ahead. The front car split off. You could hear it echo with a diminishing swoosh down one of the side tunnels.
They're separating the mining teams,
Kip said. When the car stopped, the guard spoke.
Everybody out. Link up. March to the work area.
After a long walk in total darkness, they arrived at the actual spice mining area.
We have to go deep to get the good spice deposits,
Kip said.
Down here, the glitterstim is fresh and fibrous instead of old and powdery like in the higher mines.
Before Han could say anything else, a high-pitched, teeth-jarring hum pounded against the tunnel. Then a skin of rock along the inner tunnel sloughed off. The guard had used an acoustic disruptor that penetrated only a few inches into the rock, crumbling it. Kneeling on the rubble-strewn floor, Kip showed Han and Chewbacca how to sort through the crushed rock, feeling with cold, numbed fingers through the broken pebbles and debris to pluck out strands of glitter stim like tufts of hair or asbestos fiber. During a lull, Han felt a tingle go up his spine. His ears, now attuned as his primary sense, picked up a distant rustling. It sounded like 1,000 whispering voices growing louder, picking up speed, like a hydro locomotive bulleting down a tube. A pearly glow seemed to seep out of the air.
What?
Shh, Kip answered. The prisoners had stopped working. A faint glittering dazzle, like a dense cloud of fireflies, shot through the tunnel, humming and chittering. Han ducked. Around him, he heard others also falling flat on the debris-covered floor. The glowing thing shot down the hollow tube, rolling and roiling. It suddenly arced right and plunged straight into the solid rock, vanishing like a fish falling back into the dark pool. Behind them, along the curving lengths of the tunnel, tiny blue sparks flickered from the exposed spice that had been activated by the light source whizzing past. The blue sparks sputtered and flickered and quickly faded.
What was that?
Han shouted. He heard Kip panting beside him.
Nobody knows. It's about the 15th one I've seen over the years. We call them bogies. They've never hurt anybody, or so we think. But nobody knows what's grabbing those people down in the deep mines.
At the end of the day, the workers were taken back to the muster room. When the standard lights came back on, the blinding glare was enough to make Han crouch over as if someone had punched him in the gut. He shielded his eyes. He felt a hand on his back.
It's okay, Han. Let your eyes get used to it. There's no hurry.
But Han was in a hurry to see what Kip Duran looked like. He kept blinking away tears and peering out. When he finally discerned Kip's form, he blinked again, this time in surprise. You're just a kid. Han saw a dark-haired, tousle-headed teen. He had wide eyes surrounded by dark rims, and his skin was pale from years of living in the darkness of the spice mines. Kip was wiry and tough-looking.
Don't worry, Kip said. I do the best I can.
Luke Skywalker sat alone in the cramped storage module Gantoris had given him for sleeping accommodations. Never intended as a living area, the module had few comforts, a basin of filmy water and a cloth-covered mound of dirt for a bed. Luke had his lightsaber and all the powers he had learned from Jedi training, should he decide to escape, but he didn't want to leave, not until Gantoris agreed to come with him.
Come with me.
Gantoris appeared in the square doorway. Without a word, Luke stood up and stepped outside. Where are we going? Cantoris handed him a woven pouch, then slung a similar one over his own shoulder. To get food. Tossing his thick black braid behind him, he marched toward the geyser field. Luke followed across the rugged terrain, sidestepping the lime-encrusted network of geysers and steam vents.
You must have heard something about the Order of the Jedi Knights.
Luke proceeded to tell the dark, silent man about his quest and how it had brought him to Eel Shah. He finished by asking Gantoris to join him. Gantoris looked at him with dark, unfathomable eyes.
Empires and republics mean nothing to me. What have they cared for us before? My universe is here, on this world.
He stepped in front of the wide opening to a geyser and peered into its depths. The stink of rotten eggs wafted into the air. From his hip pouch, Gantoris withdrew a battered old data pad and consulted a column of numbers that looked to be some sort of timetable.
Here, we will go inside the geyser and harvest.
Harvest what? Without answering, Gantoris lowered himself over the lip of the geyser hole. Luke shrugged off his Jedi cloak and left it beside the geyser rim, then followed the other man underground. The shaft was a narrow, winding chimney through porous rock, a pipeline for superheated water. Colorful mineral deposits sparkled white and tan and blue, powdery in his hand. Luke found plenty of footholds as he followed Gantoris into the honeycombed passages. The rock felt warm and slimy.
Gantoris worked his way into a side crevice.
What do you want me to do? In answer, Gantoris wedged himself deeper into a crack and shrugged the woven pouch off his shoulder.
Look in the dark pockets, the ones protected from the scalding water.
Gantoris dug his fingers into a crevice, felt around, and pulled out a handful of rubbery tendrils.
With the heat and the mineral deposits, the lichens have a rich growing ground. Takes a great deal of processing, but we can make something edible out of this.
Luke likewise removed his pouch and began to search in the cracks, probing with his prosthetic hand. He could read ominous intentions from Gantoris, but couldn't pinpoint them. The lichen wasn't difficult to find, and Luke quickly filled his pouch, crawling through narrow openings. Before long, he lost sight of Gantoris among the fissures.
Gantoris!
He heard no answer. Looking up the shaft of daylight poking through from the surface, Luke finally saw the man's silhouette nearly at the top. Gantoris scrambled up the jagged walls, climbing as fast as he could manage, leaving Luke behind. Luke sensed, rather than heard, the buildup of pressure deep within the planet. The water table, heated against magma, coming to a boil, rising up, finding the most direct escape. Gantoris had carried his own timetable. The geysers must erupt at regular intervals. He intended to trap Luke underground, where he would be cooked by curtains of superheated steam. Luke hauled himself up, climbing fast. The heat increased around him, making it difficult to breathe.
Then he ran out of time.
He heard the explosion deep beneath him, the roar of a plume of boiling water rushing to the surface. Luke knew he had only one chance. As the jet of steam and deadly water blasted toward him, he gathered his strength, his concentration, and sprang straight up, hurling his body out of the geyser shaft. He shot out of the geyser chimney, flailing his arms as he dropped to the ground. He tucked his shoulder and rolled, striking with enough force to knock the breath from him. A second later, a wall of steam and superheated water belched from the geyser. Luke shielded his exposed flesh and waited for the blast to dwindle.
The geyser eruption lasted several minutes. When Luke finally crawled to his knees, he saw Gantoris and the other people of Eel Shah walking toward him, their faces grim as usual. Gantoris crossed his arms over his chest and nodded.
You passed my first test, Dark Man.
Luke sensed both eagerness and terror from the man.
Now come and face your last trial.
It was like a religious procession. With Gantoris in the lead, the people of Eel Shah began a long march up the slope to the cracks of lava. Spires of lava rock jutted out of the hillside like rotten teeth. Gantoris did not slow his pace when the slope took a steep turn, but he stopped when they reached a sheltered opening in the volcano wall. Overhead, a pall of smoke and ash hung in the air.
Follow me inside, Gantoris told Luke.
The others filed past, continuing along the rugged path. Luke stepped after him. He needed to earn Gantoris's respect, if not trust. In this circumstance, Gantoris was making all the rules. Gantoris strode confidently into the dense shadows of the narrow passage. A lava tube blasted through the side of the cone to ease pressure from an ancient eruption. The lava tube spread out, revealing a boiling lake of fire. Though the fissure opened to the sky and other openings let in gusting cross drafts, the chamber felt like an oven. Squinting through noxious gases belching from the lava, Luke saw other people waiting on the far side of the chamber, their faces turned toward him. Gantoris had to raise his voice over the growling sounds of the churning magma.
Walk across the fire, dark man. If you reach the other side safely, I will allow you to teach me whatever you wish.
Without waiting for a reply, he disappeared back into the darkness of the lava tube. Luke stared after him for a moment, wondering if Gantoris could be serious. But then he noticed dark objects in the blaze of bright lava, hard stepping stones of denser rock that made a precarious path across the lake of fire. Stepping to the edge of the simmering lava, Luke peered up at the broken sky above him. Then he set his foot down on the first stepping stone. It supported his weight. He looked ahead, keeping focused on the opposite side. The gathered people kept watching. Luke moved to another step, then another. A tendril of euphoria began to rise within him. This wasn't as difficult as he had feared. Then the lava began to bubble and hiss more forcefully, gushing as something stirred below. Suddenly, a serpent-like creature burst above the surface, hissing like rocket fuel caught on fire. The fireworm had a triangular head and pointed ear tufts. Crystalline scales armored every inch of its body. Its wide eyes were jewels, glowing with a fire of their own. Insulated air intakes sucked in the hot atmosphere, filling bladders deep within the creature's core and making it rise to the surface of the lava pool, huge and fierce. As the fireworm rose and coiled above Luke, he knew he could never outrun the monster. He stopped and found secure footing and drew his lightsaber, igniting it. The green glow of his blade fought against the fiery orange of the lava chamber. The fireworm dove beneath the magma again, splashing molten rock into the air. Luke danced from stepping stone to stepping stone, trying to avoid the deadly firefall. He held his lightsaber in front of him. His every nerve was tuned, ready to respond, but he saw only the restless surface of the lava.
Where are you?
The fireworm's head exploded out of the lava on the other side, rearing up and plunging down to strike. Luke slashed with his humming green blade, but when the lightsaber smashed against the mirrored armor plates, the glowing green edge refracted into 1,000 components, splitting and ricocheting around the chamber. Sparks showered all around him. The energy blade that could supposedly slice through anything broke only one small silicon armor plate. On the other side of the chamber, the people of Ilsha ducked to escape the flying shards of green power. Luke knew he could not use the lightsaber against the monster again. The fireworm yowled in surprise more than pain, then dove for refuge under the lava. Luke crouched, trying to figure out what to do next. The fireworm would return any minute. He didn't know how much time he would have. Suddenly, the creature launched itself out of the lava, roaring and hissing and making horrible sounds. Luke turned, ready to die in battle. But now the monster had no interest in him at all. Gouts of acrid smoke poured from the chink in the silicon armor, where lava ate its way into the fireworm's body core. The creature writhed, spewing lava into the air. Molten rock devoured the fireworm's internal organs, killing it from the inside out. When the fiery rock burned through to the fireworm's inflated air bladders, the creature exploded.
Come on, just squeeze a little more speed out.
10 system patrol craft, originally designed for maximum speed to combat smugglers and pirates, surged past the Falcon and lined up in a blockade. But in the three-dimensional vastness of space, Lando managed to slip under their grasp. Laser blasts erupted all around them. Lando stared out the viewport windows at the giant battleships moving toward them and the horrifying spectacle of the Maw. Even Luke couldn't translate R2's bleeps.
Only a complete idiot would go into a place like that. Lando squeezed his eyes shut.
Then let's just hope they're not idiots, too, Luke said. Han touched the Sun Crusher's navicompt, switching it on.
This thing is in better shape than the Imperial shuttle we stole. Are all the coordinates burned into the database, Doc?
Kui nodded. sitting down primly and strapping herself into her seat. The Sun Crusher has been ready to go for years. We've just been waiting for orders from the Empire. Standing at the door, Kip stuck his head out of the narrow hatch.
Here they come! Seal that hatch, kid. We're in here for the duration now. Chewie, have you found the weapons controls yet?
In the co-pilot's chair, Chewbacca ran his huge hands over the buttons and dials. Finally, he found what he wanted. Defensive laser cannons, mounted at different targeting angles, swiveled as Chewbacca tested the aiming mechanisms. Small thuds banged against the Sun Crusher's hull as the stormtroopers fired their blaster rifles, causing no damage. Han looked at Kui. We don't even have the shields on.
This armor will hold against anything they can throw against us, she said with a smug smile. It was designed to.
Han grinned.
Well, in that case, let's take a few extra seconds and do this right.
He worked the controls, activating the repulsor lift engines. The interior of the Sun Crusher wobbled as the entire craft rose into the air, floating on its repulsor cushion. Outside, they could hear the faint screeching of an alarm.
Chewie, point those laser cannons straight up. Let's give ourselves a 21-gun salute right through the roof.
Without waiting for Han to give the order, the Wookiee fired all of the Sun Crusher's weaponry at once. The ceiling of the hangar chamber blasted outward under the barrage of laser energy. Some of the larger chunks of rubble fell downward, clanging against the Sun Crusher's hull. But most of the skylights burst into space with an outrush of contained air that spewed into the maw. Stormtroopers were sucked out through the breach, flotsam among the debris in low orbit around the clustered rocks. Han raised the Sun Crusher up, accelerating through the escape hole. They shot into open space, and Han felt an exhilaration he had not felt since they had first arrived at Kessel.
Here goes nothing. Now for the fun part.
Staring down at the installation from the Gorgon's bridge, Admiral Dalla saw the puff of an explosion on one of the rocks of Maw installation. Then the tiny form of the Sun Crusher streaked by, a characteristically angular speck fleeing the confines of the planetoid containing it.
Red alert! Mobilize all forces! They have the Sun Crusher!
But, Admiral,
said the Star Destroyer's captain,
if the technical reports are correct, nothing can harm the Sun Crusher.
Dalla fixed Commander Kratos with her gaze.
Understand this, Commander. We cannot forfeit the Sun Crusher. Retrieve them at all costs.
Three Star Destroyers closed in behind the stolen Sun Crusher.
Didn't take them long to figure something was up,
said Han. Clouds of TIE fighters spewed out of the launching bays of the Star Destroyers Manticore and Gorgon, swarming toward them in dense formations. Flashing, splattering laser bolts struck like pelting raindrops on the viewscreen.
What are they doing? Trying to smother us or just confuse us?
Kui shouted. The Sun Crusher, undamaged, rocked left and right from the pummeling of blaster strikes.
No, but they can wipe out our external weaponry. In fact, they already have.
Han checked the readouts.
Every one of our lasers is offline.
We just have to outrun them, then, Kip said.
Another Star Destroyer, the Basilisk, unleashed its squadrons of TIE fighters.
Whoever heard of a traffic jam in a black hole cluster?
Said Han. The fourth and last Star Destroyer reared up between them and the outside universe, blocking their passage. The Hydra lanced out with its enormous turbo-laser cannons, aiming concentrated firepower at the single small ship. The remaining three Star Destroyers pressed in from behind to cut off their escape through the maze of the black hole cluster.
All right, hold on. Time to accelerate for whatever this fancy toy is worth.
Han pulled the control levers back. The sudden force shoved the four escapees back into their seats as the Sun Crusher surged forward, straight toward the Hydra. The huge battleship grew larger and larger, filling their entire field of view and still expanding. Great green turbo laser bolts shot out at them, but the cannons could not refocus their aim points fast enough to compensate for the ship streaking directly at them.
Han, what are you doing? Kip cried.
Trust me. Or rather, trust her.
Han nodded toward Kui.
If she messed up her test measurements, we're all going to be one big organic pancake.
The Hydra's trapezoidal bridge tower rushed toward them directly in their path. One suicidal TIE fighter rammed into the Sun Crusher to deflect its course, but merely exploded upon hitting the invincible quantum armor. Han had no trouble compensating for the error in trajectory.
"Look out!" Kui yelled.
Details of the bridge tower filled their view now as they screamed toward the Imperial battleship. Han could actually see the windows of the bridge, the tiny figures of the command crew, some of them paralyzed in horror, others fleeing madly.
Right down their throat!
The armored Sun Crusher tore through the Hydra's control bridge like a bullet. Flying debris sprayed in their wake. The ship shot out the other side, shredding the superstructure on its way out. The impact knocked them into a temporary stupor. Han finally whooped.
"We've made it!"
Behind them, the great battleship erupted in flames.
"You're crazy."
"Don't thank me yet, Doc."
Burning, out of control, the decapitated Hydra wheeled backward, drifting helplessly toward the gravitational trap of one of the black holes.
"Now, we're not home free by a long shot. Okay, Kip, now it's your turn to take the controls. Get us out of here."
On the Gorgon's bridge, Admiral Dalla watched as the Hydra crumpled. Though her expression was carved in ice, hot tears burned unshed in Dalla's eyes. Glinting with its maddening invincibility, the Sun Crusher streaked through the wreckage.
"After them!" Dalla yelled. "Full pursuit!"
Kip Duron half closed his eyes as he looked through a mental vision of the perilous maze to safety. He jerked the ship to starboard, then plunged down, frantically avoiding unseen obstacles. Han kept a firm, reassuring pressure on the boy's shoulder. Hot gas blazed around them. Kwee-Zook stared at Kip and his blind piloting, her dark blue eyes wide and her face transfixed with horror. Abruptly, the curtain of gas parted in front of them, peeling away to reveal the black infinity of open space. At last, they were free of the Maw. In their mad run away from the forces of Kessel, Luke and Lando tried to push through the clustered capital ships. They winced simultaneously every time a bolt impacted the Falcon shields. "Just get us into the Maw. It's our only chance."
"I never thought I'd be keeping my fingers crossed for that to happen."
Lando hunched over the controls.
"R2, see if you can pump up the front shields. We're going to take quite a pounding from that strike cruiser when we pass by. One good hit, we're fried."
"Wait."
Luke squinted at the swirling gases ahead of him.
"Something's coming out." The thorn-like form of the Sun Crusher streaked away from the cluster, leaving a trail of hot gases. A few moments later, three fully armed Imperial-class Star Destroyers charged out of the Maw like banthas on fire.
Han Solo's sigh of relief turned into an exclamation of dismay as he saw the array of Kessel's battle fleet massed in front of them, weapons already blazing.
"Where did all those ships come from? They can't still be waiting for us."
Chewbacca jabbed his hairy finger at the viewport, pointing to a ship at the vanguard of the gathered attack forces, the Millennium Falcon.
Han's lip curled. "I'm gonna get that slime merchant who's flying my ship. We'll ram them like we did that Star Destroyer."
"Han, it looks to me like those other ships are chasing the Falcon. They're shooting at it."
Kui agreed with Kip.
"That light freighter doesn't appear to be part of the attacking fleet."
"Look at the rear screens, Han," said Kip.
The Star Destroyers Gorgon, Basilisk, and Manticore burst out, giant demons loaded with destructive weaponry from the fallen Empire.
"Where in the universe did those Star Destroyers come from?"
Lando asked. Lando looked down at the beeping comm.
"We're getting a message over the Falcon's private comm frequency."
Lando frowned.
"How would anybody know to transmit that? How would anybody even know the Falcon's private code?" "Whoever's on the Falcon better have a damn good reason for flying my ship."
"Han, is that you?"
A sudden thrill surged through Luke.
"Lando, what are you doing here?"
In space around them, blinding lances of light flashed as the weapons of two fleets were brought to bear. Like rival crate dragons in mating season, the Kessel and Imperial forces slammed into each other in a total free-for-all space brawl. Han, listen to me. Luke is here, too. We've got to get away from Kessel, but the Falcon's navicomputer is disabled. We can't make the jump into hyperspace. An explosion rocked them from the starboard side, but most of the Kessel fighters concentrated their firepower on the much larger threat of Dala's Imperial fleet. Though hopelessly outmatched, the three Carrick cruisers lined up and began to blast the Star Destroyer Basilisk. Over the private comm channel, they could hear Han speaking to someone else. Then he answered Lando.
We can dump the coordinates to your Navicomp and we'll fly tandem back to Coruscant.
Lando checked the computer and raised a fist in triumph.
Got it! R2, get ready to go.
You'd better keep my ship safe, Lando. On my signal.
You have my word, Han. Lando's fingers flew over the Falcon's familiar controls.
Ready to enter hyperspace.
The Kessel forces flanked and attacked the far larger Star Destroyers, pummeling the Imperial ships with blasts from their ion cannons and turbo laser banks. But the Star Destroyers disgorged their own squadrons of TIE fighters to butcher the unregimented forces from Kessel. On your mark, Han.
Punch it!
The last thing they saw was Kessel's massive Laurinar strike cruiser exploding under the concerted fire from the Basilisk and the Gorgon. They watched the flaming hulk reel and ram into the Star Destroyer Manticore, causing the bottom of the Arrowhead hull to buckle and burn. Then the universe filled with starlines. The reunion was everything Han had imagined. Leia and the twins met him the moment the Suncrusher and the Millennium Falcon touched down side by side at the high landing platform. Han backed out of the Suncrusher's hatch and began climbing down the ladder, but Leia ran forward and hugged him before he managed to get all the way down. Glad I'm back? I missed you, Leia said, kissing him.
I know.
She put her hands on her hips.
What? You didn't miss me?
Han turned away sheepishly.
Well, first we crashed on Kessel, then we were stuck in the spice mines, then we got captured by a bunch of Imperials in the middle of a black hole cluster.
When Leia looked as if she was going to punch him, Han grinned.
But even through all that, I don't remember more than about 2 seconds when I didn't miss you.
Leia kissed him again. R2 trundled down the Falcon's ramp, and 3PO bustled to greet him.
R2-D2, I'm so glad you're back. You wouldn't believe the difficulties I've had while you were gone.
Nobody bothered to translate. Kip Duran and Kwee-Zoox climbed down from the Sun Crusher and stared out at the endless spires and towers of Imperial City.
Now that's a city, Kip said.
Kwee looked overwhelmed. The Sun Crusher would be transferred to a high-security hangar for study by the scientists of the New Republic. Kwee did not like abandoning it, but she had no choice. Han strode over to his two children, bending his knees and gathering Jason and Jaina into his arms.
Hey, kids, you remember your daddy? It's been a long time, huh?
Jason nodded. Then a moment later, Jaina nodded as well. Han wasn't sure he believed their answer.
Well, if you don't remember me, I'll try to make it up to you from now on.
A puffed-up official wearing the bright uniform of an off-world administrative office finally cornered Lando in the highbrow diplomatic lounge. The official held an armored briefcase similar to the type credit investigators carried.
Are you Lando Calrissian?
The official said.
I've been attempting to locate you for several days.
Yes, you finally caught me. What do you want? I can get the best legal representation in the galaxy here in Imperial City.
That won't be necessary.
The investigator fiddled with the cipher lock of his armored briefcase. Seated beside Lando, Han raised his eyebrows. The official opened the case and glittering light spilled out. The briefcase brimmed with carefully sorted packets of fire facet gems and shimmering chrysopras.
I am from the planet Dagul, and this is the reward owed to you by the Duchess Mistal.
for the safe return of her beloved consort, Dak, also known as Timo. You can have them appraised, but I am told these jewels are valued at approximately 1,000,000 credits, plus the briefcase, which is worth another 40.
Han clapped Lando on the shoulder. What are you going to do with all that money? Still thinking of investing it in spice mining? Lando came back to reality with a streak of defensiveness.
I hate to say this, but when Morath Duel showed us around, I was rather impressed by the potential there. Spice has plenty of good uses, too. Perfectly legitimate alternatives in psychological therapy, criminal investigation, communication with alien races, even artistic inspiration and entertainment. You knew that, Han, or you wouldn't have run Spice yourself in the old days.
You got a point, Lando.
Besides, I'm in the market for a new ship. I had to leave the Lady Luck stranded on Kessel.
Seeing the eager stares from the others in the lounge, Lando snapped shut the lid of the armored briefcase.
Well, anyway, it's wonderful just to be solvent again.
Luke looked deep into the eyes of Kip Duran, searching for the core of a Jedi. The younger man flinched, but continued to meet Luke's gaze. Han interrupted them, clapping his hand on Kip's shoulder.
Oh, you should have been there to watch him zipping through the dark spice tunnels, and he navigated us right through the maw with his eyes closed. This kid has a lot of potential, Luke.
Luke nodded. I was about to do that trick in the maw myself. I know how difficult it must have been.
Does that mean you'll take me for your Jedi Academy? I want to know how to use this power I have. While I was sitting in a cell on the Star Destroyer, I vowed never to be helpless again.
Luke withdrew the power pack and sheet crystal sensor paddles from the old Imperial scanner that had once been used to detect Jedis.
Let's try this scanner first.
Untangling the cords, Luke stretched out the sheet crystal paddles on either side of Kip.
This won't hurt. It just maps the potential of your senses.
He tripped the scan switch on the control pack, and a narrow line of coppery light traveled down Kip's body, as a smaller image of the copper scan line reappeared in reverse motion in front of them, digitalizing its analysis of Kip Duran. Kip's reproduction hung in the air, bathed with the pale blue corona Luke had found on the others with genuine Jedi potential, but the aura waxed and waned, knotting itself, turning darker, growing brighter, streaked with red, then becoming tangled.
What does that mean?
He's okay, isn't he?
Han seemed eager to have his protege accepted. Luke wondered at the anomalous mapping, disturbed because he didn't know how to interpret it. The shimmer could be a result of faulty scanning equipment since the instrument had been roughly treated and could no longer be calibrated, or it could be that because of the strain and pressure on Kip for so many years, he hadn't quite sprung back to his full potential yet.
I see a lot of power there, a lot, Luke said.
And Kip sighed at the reassurance.
Let me try one other test.
Luke stretched out his hands to touch the curly black hair on Kip's head.
Let him do what he needs to do, Han whispered to the young man. Trust him.
Luke closed his eyes and sent a tendril of thought to the back of Kip's mind, where the deep primal memories hid, leaving little room for conscious thought. Luke touched inward to the isolated nub in his subconscious. He pushed
and suddenly found himself hurled backward, tossed aside like a piece of fluff in a B-spin windstorm. He landed flat on his back on the other side of the room, gasping.
Han and Kip ran toward him as he struggled to prop himself on his elbows. Luke shook the daze from his head.
I'm sorry. I don't know what I did. I didn't try to, honest.
What happened? What does that mean for Kip?
Luke blinked, then smiled at the others. Don't worry about me. I triggered that myself. He shook his head.
Kip, you have amazing power.
Luke stood up and gripped the young man's hand.
You're definitely welcome to train at my academy. I just hope I know how to handle it when you come into full control of your abilities.
Luke Skywalker, Jedi Master, stood atop the great temple on the fourth moon of Yavin.
Below his feet lay the empty throne room and grand audience chamber, with skylights open to the sun. Garbed in a new Jedi cloak, wearing his lightsaber at his side, Luke felt warmth bathing him. Spicy, lingering scents rose as steam from the lush rainforest below. The ancient ruins left behind by the vanished Masasi race sprawled out in great geometrical edifices now overgrown by voracious jungles. Luke stood on top of the ziggurat that had once been a towering lookout station when the Alliance base had been housed on Yavin 4. In the sky, a swollen sphere of pale orange filled most of his view, the looming planet of Yavin. The bloated gas giant had been a shield for the Alliance base as the first Death Star orbited into position to fire with its planet-destroying superlaser. The Yavin base had been abandoned by the Alliance years before, but many of the broken stone structures were still serviceable. Having heard that the Maw fleet had survived the battle at Kessel, with Admiral Dalla no doubt still bent on the New Republic's destruction, Luke knew how desperately the Alliance needed a group of guardians. When Mon Mothma and Leia had offered Luke the abandoned Alliance base, he had jumped at the chance. To begin his actual training, Luke tried to recreate all the exercises Yoda had taught him on Dagobah, as well as the practice sessions Obi-Wan Kenobi had begun. Luke also had the ancient Jedi holocron, the visual historical database Leia had taken from the resurrected Emperor's stronghold. He had studied the information from the hidden repository of Jedi knowledge on Dathomir. He had many tools, and his students carried inside themselves doorways to great power. But again, Luke worried. If one of his trainees, or more than one, fell to the dark side, would he himself have the power to bring him back? And who was this dark man who haunted Gantoris's dreams with prophecies of destruction? As Luke regarded the sweeping vista of dense wilderness, he saw wide burned scars where fires had ravaged the rainforests. But the ecology of the moon had struck back with a vengeance, healing itself. Dense clusters of sharp-smelling blue-leaf shrubs, Masasi trees, and climbing ferns clogged the ground in an impenetrable mesh that stretched as far as he could see, broken only by scattered temple ruins poking through the greensward. The bizarre alien constructions left behind by the Masasi seemed filled with secrets and knowledge of their own. Luke blinked his eyes and felt the power of the place around him, the wonder, the mystery of it all. He could not wait to begin bringing his students here. It was the perfect place to train a new order of Jedi Knights. This is Anthony Heald. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Star Wars Jedi Search by Kevin J. Anderson. This program was produced by David Rapkin and directed by Lars Hoel. Abridgment by Trebby Johnson. Star Wars Jedi Search is a production of Lucasfilm Limited, copyright 1994, all rights reserved. Star Wars Jedi Search, Volume 1 of the Jedi Academy Trilogy, is available in paperback wherever Bantam books are sold.